Chairman, we are now recording.
All right, thank you. We will call this meeting to order at 9 a.m. Thank you all for being here. May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Sterin?
Present.
Mr. Skaggs?
Present.
Mr. Elson?
Present.
Mr. Sales?
Present.
Mr. Smith? Hey, we have a quorum.
All right. And we will have our call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Pursuant to ARS 38431, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the members are properly noticed for discussion of legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. And I believe we have at least one public member.
Mr. Kane?
Would that be me?
That would be you.
No, I have no questions.
Okay.
No statement. No.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anyone online, Kirk?
No, I didn't receive anything from the public indicating that they wish to speak during the call.
All right, excellent. All right, hearing nothing else from the public. Just on the agenda here, folks, we will go ahead and do the meeting adoption and then adjust the agenda a little bit on five. So let's go ahead and take a look at the minutes from last meeting. Here's a tab. 4A for for our September minutes, and we will entertain a motion to accept the minutes.
This is Scott Sales. I'm going to abstain from this since I was not here.
That's fine.
So, yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move to accept the minutes as written.
Okay, and we could use a second then, Mr. Elway, if you're so inclined.
Yeah, I'll second it.
Thank you. Any discussion? I'm sorry, Elson, excuse me.
No problem.
I don't see anything else.
Mr. Chairman, just who wasn't present at the last meeting, so can you set a second on that?
For the minutes, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good question, Mr. Skaggs.
Anything else?
Yeah, I think we had everything in there that we needed to, everything documented. I see no changes. So all those in favor of accepting the September 6th minutes as written, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion passes for accepting the last meeting's minutes. On our agenda, we have, we're going to juggle a little bit and move Mr. LaMountain, who's currently on agenda item 5B as in Baker, so he can go first and might work better with his schedule. And then we'll follow on with 5A after that. I'm not sure if we're going to get to all of the agenda items on 5E and F. We'll see how our morning goes. I don't really have any interest in a meeting into the afternoon here, so we're looking for a lunchtime. We'll stop. So, Mr. LaMountain, am I saying your name correctly, sir?
You are.
Great. First, I want to thank you for being here. We appreciate your time, and if you could please introduce yourself and please give us a little more information about your perspective on the education side.
Great. First of all, thank you very much for allowing me to present this morning. I always appreciate the opportunity to talk about what we do and the importance of licensing institutions in the state of Arizona, and certainly as it relates to the home inspectors that we'll be discussing here in a few minutes. My name is Kevin LaMountain. I'm the Executive Director for the Arizona State Board for Private Postsecondary Education. Our board licenses all private postsecondary schools in the state of Arizona. Currently, there are 235 institutions that we license, ranging anywhere from dog grooming schools all the way through and including doctoral programs at Grand Canyon University, Creighton University, Mayo Clinic, So any institution that is not the three state universities or the nine community colleges all fall under the licensing authority of our board. Specifically, I know today we were wanting to talk about the home inspectors training programs. And I do have a few questions that was that were provided to me by your board, and I would like to address some of those, and then completely open this up to question and answer anything that you any questions that you would have regarding that.
That sounds great.
So, the one of the questions that was presented to me it says, "What are the advantages of having all home inspector education providers licensed with our board?" Well, if they fall under the physical presence section, meaning that they have a physical location in the state of Arizona, and their courses are 40 hours or above, or cost more than $1,000, they actually, every home inspector school has to be licensed by our board. That fits the vocational component of licensure in a requirement, so they all would require that licensure. The next question is, how does a school become licensed? What would cause them to become unlicensed? Can a notification system be established from us to your board, to the BTR, if made aware of any school that's no longer licensed? So I guess the first question is, how does a school become licensed? I believe there's at least one individual on your board that is licensed by our licensing body. So that process is pretty simple. It is an application process that can take anywhere from, it typically takes about 2 to 3 months to get the application completed and into our board, and then have the board approve the institution as a licensed institution. There's a lot of requirements that are associated with that, including facility inspection, insurance, protections for students, catalogs, enrollment agreements. There are requirements to protect students in terms of transcripts and documentation requirements. So there's quite a bit that has to go through that process. Our staff reviews them, and then we present them to the board for final approval. What would cause an institution to become unlicensed would be if there are violations, institutions that are not following their established process and program information, if there are numerous complaints that show that there might be safety or security issues with the school as it relates to the students, and any violation of statute or rule that we have may cause an institution to be either placed on a probationary period or could result in revocation of the license. So hopefully that gives you the an understanding of that particular part of it. In terms of the communication between our board and BTR, is I think, you know, I've known Judy for a long time, and we have been connected quite a bit over the years, and certainly as we find issues and challenges, and if an institution were to to come before the board and had any action to their license, we would provide that information to the BTR board and let them know what the challenges are and what we're experiencing with the institution. And I would hope the same happens, and I know we had a conversation a couple of days ago, that it goes the other way too. If for some reason your board is receiving a number of complaints from students regarding an institution, that would be something that we would certainly want to know about, so that we have an investigator, and that we would go through our investigation as well to find out the challenges that students are having with that particular institution. Another question that was presented to me, it says the BTR wishes to specify specific course content and program hours for Arizona home inspection training, and what would that need to look like if we were to implement something? So in the licensing process, we ask and require from the institution a list of courses that they teach and certain outcomes. I will tell you, we have currently in our licensing with the 235 schools, there's 300,000 students that are in these programs that we license. There's over 11,000 different programs, degree programs, and vocational programs that we monitor. And there's five of us. So to tell you, we have the experience and the depth to go in and find out the difference between what a home inspector would learn and what a medical doctor that is studying cardiology would know, is we don't have that ability to review curriculum depth. So we look for other partners to do things such as that. So I've used the example of the Board of Nursing. We've got quite a few nursing programs and a lot of nurses that go through our programs in Arizona. The Board of Nursing, it has the authority in their education committees to review curriculum, to approve curriculum. Once that curriculum has been approved, they send that information to us. Our board reviews it, knows that that has been looked at in detail through the Board of Nursing and has been approved. And then we then would approve the institution for the institution licensure to allow them to teach those programs in the state of Arizona. And that's great because, you know, again, we don't have the understanding and the knowledge to be able to know what goes into a program. And obviously, in the Board of Nursing's example, they have many requirements in order for you to become a nurse and certified and go through their licensing process. So similar to what you do, too, is that there's a number of hours that are required and processes that need to come to play before an institute or before an individual could get licensed by your board. So that could certainly leave ourselves open to a conversation. We can't do it. You can't do it by ourselves, but certainly the opportunity to look towards changing rules and potentially changing some statutes in the future may be able to align where we are and where you are so that we're making sure that the best possible outcome for the student is there. And that's certainly a conversation that I would be very open to having both with your board and with the governor's office and the legislature as we come into the 24 legislative session and beyond. And then another question that was presented, can we license individuals who provide training such as parallel inspectors? And the answer to that is no. We don't license individuals in any way, shape, or form, but we do license the institution. So, for example, if BTR made the decision to attach the parallel inspector component to the education, making it a requirement, and you bunch those together that state that you can't complete a program of study without the parallel component that is attached to the school, if that's that, then the answer is absolutely. If it's separate, no. Unfortunately, we have the ability to do that and require that. So that would, again, come back to what we could work together, you know, moving forward if that is a part and you can attend to that.
Kevin, this is Judy.
Yes.
Before you go on too, I think it's important to note that when we were kind of having this discussion on the possibility of linking the parallels as part of the education, that again we were drawing similarities between, like, say you were going to be a radiology technician or a nursing, whatever, something, there's clinical hours involved, and the school is responsible for ensuring the student receive all of the clinical hours necessary that they would need for licensure. So again, I know it's not medical we're talking about, but it's similar. You know, we're talking about clinical hours with the parallel inspection. So I just wanted to throw that out. Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you for picking that up. And it really does, it's very similar to that. So we have a number of programs for medical assisting, dental assisting, nursing. There's so many different programs that are out there, primarily in the healthcare area, that require a hands-on externship or clinical component to what they do. I have a welding school that requires a number of hours that are outside of classroom instruction that have to go through and understand that welding program. So it's very program specific. So yes, I think that this would, if there is the requirement from you that states that it has to be put, you know, together, then we would have no issue with making sure that that is a requirement that would be completed as part of the licensing process. And then last piece, and then certainly open it up to any questions that you have. I know that there's some concern, and there's a concern on my part too, mm-hmm. about schools that are online, fully online, that are offering their education out of Montana, Wyoming, New Mexico, any place other than Arizona. So in statute, we have a requirement to be licensed in Arizona that states that you need to have what is determined as physical presence. And physical presence in Arizona is defined by a facility, a person, a number of people, but there has to be something in the state of Arizona that a person is located at, right? So they can still do online, fully online from Arizona, but their LLC or their registrar, their something has Arizona-specific address, then that would require that particular institution to be licensed. Institutions that are not in the state of Arizona, there is no statute at this time or rule at this time that would prevent a person from New Mexico delivering online education in the state of Arizona. Those students have no protection under Arizona state law. They have no protection under our, we have a student tuition recovery fund, an STRF fund, that if an Arizona institution were to cease operations, and they had students that were harmed, meaning students that had paid tuition, but they didn't complete that program, our fund would allow that process to make that student whole financially and pay them back for the tuition that is paid. For those students that are in an online program that are in a different state, they are exempt from that fund. And it really puts the student at risk, because I don't know if they are aware that they're exempt from that, because we don't license them. An institution's licensed in Arizona, the schools pay into that fund, and if something were to happen, we then provide a process for them to get that restitution back. So that's certainly something that we, in our rulemaking moving going forward, I've requested an opportunity to review rules and create new rules in the 2024-25 time frame, and that is something that we're going to address of this online piece that it could potentially harm Arizona students. So I think those were the questions that were provided to me up front, and I would be happy to answer any question that you all might have about what we do and, you know, anything in terms of partnering.
Sure. Thank you, Kevin. I'm sure we'll have a couple questions, and I'm going to kick it off here. Just back to the Arizona requirement, is it a facility or an address requirement?
It's really an address requirement, more so than the facility. If you're doing completely online, you just need to, you know, tell us where your administrative people are going to be. Could be somebody's home, right? So we know in most of the home inspector schools, there's typically one person that operates the institution, that operates the school. They're typically doing that out of their home and or out of their business address.
Right, right. And do you have, are you currently working with other disciplines with the Board of Technical Registration?
No, everything else that we do is accredited by other national associations.
Okay, all right. Do you have an annual renewal fee for these organizations, Kevin?
Yes. We do. So every license is renewable with every year. So and then there's a fee that's associated with that. And it's depending upon the institution's gross tuition revenue. So there's a sliding scale that goes anywhere from an $800 fee to a $6,000 fee. $6,000 fee is going to be an institution like Grand Canyon University that has $1.2 billion in revenue a year. Small schools which typically most of the home inspector schools fall under, are going to be certainly on the lower end of that scale.
Great, thank you. So if it's distance learning only, then you don't have any jurisdiction, essentially, and no control for that matter, if it's distance only in that scenario,
right?
It's
not so much that it's distance only, right, Kevin, but if they're not licensed with private post-secondary education, or PPSE, if they're not licensed with PPSE, they have no jurisdiction.
Right, and so anybody that's doing online out of Arizona, they would be required licensure, and we would have authority over those. But if they're in any of the 49 other states, we have no authority over those institutions.
Got it.
At this time.
Yeah, you know, one of our challenges is that we've got all different kinds of education providers, and we do sometimes get complaints from the students on the quality of the education. And it's real loose right now, and so that's one of the reasons why we're having this consideration. Open up the floor for questions. Anyone have any questions for Kevin? If not, I may find one more here.
Well, I mean, we've also shared with Kevin that we've had experiences where annoying student home inspector has taken education online from an entity that's not. So right now we have three possibilities. You can either be licensed with PPSE or
distance education accrediting commission or an accrediting agency approved by the U.S. Department of Education.
So it's pretty loose. Occasionally somebody, I mean, this person took education from an entity that had all over their website that they were approved in Arizona, and a lot of times they even say approved by technical registration. They weren't approved by any of those three entities, so they, you know, and that happens too, right. I think. And again, there's no protection at all for the student, no way for them to be made whole financially for having paid and gone through that and have nothing that we're able to use legally.
Yeah, and I can see the advantage of the recovery fund there to help protect when these conditions happen. You know, we've got two real important legs in our licensing, Kevin, and I'm thinking about this more on the licensing side. And one is our 84 hours of curriculum, and the other is 30 parallel training inspections, if you will. Some of our education providers kind of put the umbrella around and package the parallel physical on-site inspections, and some don't. Understanding what you had already said on you're probably overworked and don't have time to even review curriculums for that matter, would there be any jurisdiction if that education provider is also providing parallel inspections, then your board would then have some oversight on those parallels too if it's provided by the same organization, is that correct?
As long as it's part of the curriculum, so anything that's intertwined inside of that curriculum then falls under our authority. So if someone is not following along with what the student in the catalog and in the enrollment agreement, so I as a student go in and I sign that enrollment agreement, it says I'm going to get this number of hours of instruction and this number of hours that is required for that parallel inspection, and is all combined as part of the agreement that the student signs with the institution, then absolutely we have the authority. If the institution is not providing that, we will, if once we know about it, if a student were to talk to you or a student were to talk to us, we would instantly open an investigation as to why that isn't happening, and then they would be brought before the board. So as long as it's in there, if it is separate, that here's your education, here's the hours. Oh, and by the way, you also have to go find your own parallel inspector to go out and do all these other requirements in order to meet the licensure requirement, then that would be different.
Right. So it could be inside or outside your jurisdiction, depending on how it's packaged, essentially, right?
Correct.
Okay. Well, And let me interject too. So obviously, if we were going to have it included as part of the curriculum, that, you know, that would be part of that education role package that we're talking about. And I think I can also speak for Kevin when I say he has no desire to vet all of this curriculum, but what he's suggesting, similar to nursing or the other things we were comparing to, is we would need to, again, tweak our rules as well. But that would come to this board, the HIRSC committee, to vet the curriculums. And right. I think, again, if we were patterning after other agencies, it would be something that would be done annually. So the schools would submit their curriculum for review. You're going to vet it. Does it meet everything? Check the boxes, requirements. And then I would assume, Kevin, there's probably something in the agreement with the educational entity that says if you change anything, you have to let the know. So all of the vetting of the, which right now there's none, we know that. There's no national accrediting institution for home inspector school training. We just have a checklist. Do you meet all these things? We have no idea, you know, for the most part, what's going on and no control over it. Neither does Kevin, you know, or PPSC. So I think that would really help a lot if this committee could actually vet the curriculum and we could work more hand in hand with PPSC. I love the idea of having the parallels be a requirement of the education.
Yeah. I was going to bring up that same question. You're always ahead of me by one, by the way. But
winning.
So what I think, from what I understand, Kevin, is if the Home Inspectors Rules and Standards Committee could look at the syllabus, approve the syllabus, present that to the post-secondary, that's how we can control what is being taught or not.
What? I mean, I think this committee would approve that it would go before the board for acceptance, and then... Right, so Kevin, if we were both able to tweak our rules, it would be that they have to be registered correctly with PPSC, but also he couldn't do that unless technical registration had also said, yes, this curriculum.
Yeah, that's correct. So the way that we do it with the nursing, so the institution typically goes to the Board of Nursing first, and they say, this is the curriculum. We want to bring a new nursing school to Arizona. This is what we have, and this is what we're going to do, and this is our curriculum. Then once it goes through the education committee in the Board of Nursing, then they provide us a letter that states we approve the curriculum. And once we have that, and it's actually we're working at both of them at the same time, so they're really both applying for us and for Board of Nursing at the same time. Once we get that letter, then we activate the license. Well, they'll have to go through the board, right, and get approval. But then that letter states from Board of Nursing that it meets all the state requirements, that the Board of Nursing is reviewing curriculum on an annual basis, that they have to, the institution has to report both to the Board of Nursing and to us any change in curriculum, any change in hours, anything like that. Board of Nursing, again, will go through and approve, and if they don't approve it, or if the Board of Nursing has an issue with what's happening, then they tell us that there's a problem, and then we both get together, and in the case of some schools that we've had over the last couple of years in nursing, we both put together stipulated agreements for the institutions that they have to follow to get them on the right path to make sure that they're doing the right thing for the students. So our agreements all are in alignment, but that's the process that we're using right now with the Board of Nursing, and there's a couple other boards that we do that with as well.
So Kevin, hi, I'm John Elson. I'm one of the new members of the committee. About 10 years ago, I applied for and ran a state-licensed inspector training school here in Arizona. And I just want to say a couple things. Number one, I'm not sure that you were involved at the time 10 years ago, but your organization did a great job. They were rigorous about going through our curriculum review, and I have a strong feeling that if we get a higher level of consistency in terms of what we're offering school to school that'll benefit all the inspectors in the state. And so I think if we can integrate that with what our approach is, or at least unify it and then present it to you, we'll be, you know, a rising tide will raise all boats. And so I feel very strongly that if we're going to bring in the parallel side or add other components, that it needs to be under some review and aegis of your organization to achieve that.
Great. I think it's great. You know, and again, as a consumer, I'm just in the process of selling the home we're currently in and buying a new one. And just as a consumer, I know our inspector came out last week, gave us a detailed report, but, you know, I want the best person with the best training possible to make sure that, you know, the money that we pay, the money that the buyer paid for this house is being well spent, knowing that there's a solid understanding of what they're looking at and what they're doing. So I'm always here for the consumer too.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Mr. Kane had a comment.
Yes, please.
Just a quick question, so make sure I understand. So are we saying that if this goes through, that the parallels would have to go through a school, would have to be attached to a school?
We're not, we're just discussing things.
That is what we're talking about.
But that there's a potential.
So then the individual home inspector would no longer have the opportunity to make an income from parallel
inspection. Not necessarily. You can work for the school.
Well, I think and correct me if I'm wrong, but you own a school, correct? Yeah, so you're sitting here making judgment on something that will enrich you. That's part of the conflict that I hear from the home inspectors all the time, that their competition is sitting on the board and can make rulings that affect them.
Well,
so basically, we're just taking the individual home inspector out, though, someone that's been in here for 20 years, and we're saying you can no longer make an income from parallels unless you go through the school.
So this is.
Do I understand that correctly? I'm just asking. I'm not making a judgment call.
It's just a high level discussion.
It's a high level discussion right now. And I can also say that because Mr. Smith is sitting in a public member board seat and does own a school, that were this to come to the board, he would have to recuse from any vote on that as well.
Right. Okay. No, that's just one of.
Yeah, and thank you.
I've done this
comments.
For 20 years. That's one of the complaints I get a lot from home inspectors is that they think it's a conflict of interest that their competition is part of the board, and so they don't come to make complaints because they're afraid of being blackballed, singled out. The word gets through the real estate industry. Don't do business with them because they're going to cause waves. So they don't come in.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, there is nothing like that politically going on with this committee. Nothing in the slightest sense.
Not insinuating at all. No. I'm here.
I'm here
for your pay to play, and I just happen to hear all this, and I'm like, okay, wait a minute. Are we
Great.
Saying that? Okay.
Thank you for your comments.
I have a comment. Can I just
add
to that? My thought would be companies who give away parallels for free, who don't charge, would be registered with the school, but they could do it without charging. But you'd want to give the money back to the student if parallels were part of the school fee, because we don't charge. It's part of our training, part of our selling point. Hey, come work with us. We don't charge for parallels, and we'll continue. They get like 100 inspections before they're on their own. But you'd want them to they're not 30's not good enough. But they want their money back or not to be charged for that if they get their parallels for someone who does it for free.
Sure.
But if you're doing, your company's doing it for your employees, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And that's a perk that they get? Well, that's fine. You can do more after you get the license. 30's required. After that,
yeah, but these
30,
their 0 through 30 would be with us. They wouldn't have to go pay $3,000 or $3,500 to somebody else for that. And if they had to pay that through the school, we would want to be registered with the schools, but we're doing it for free.
Yeah.
They would need to get their money back.
The whole idea is trying to control help
the quality
of these parallels, because there's a lot that just don't meet it. And I'm telling you, every month I see a parallel inspector has done an evaluation on a student. The student report comes in for review, and it lacks so much that's required. That's what we're trying to address. And then later on, they get violated.
Yeah.
I do hope you stay active as this, you know, discussion continues at further meetings.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'd like to.
So, Kevin, right now we've got some number, maybe a dozen or so of education providers, probably some more, and three quarters of them are currently licensed through your board. And some of those may be also including the parallels, if you will, within their contractual agreement with the students. So there's, you know, at this point, from your standpoint, there's no, as you mentioned before, you're not reviewing curriculum. And if right now, as it stands, where our current rules are, you know, there's no oversight currently from you to that organization. And I guess what I'm asking is, you're doing some of that for us now. Is there any kind of experience? Is there anything else we should know? Because some of our education providers have been licensed with you for many years. So I don't know if there's any history there at all.
I do want to, in terms of the curriculum, and I want to make it really clear, we do look at curriculum, right? We do make sure that the hours match what is in the catalog and in the enrollment agreement, make sure that the coursework is, you know, understandable to the student. What I do mean about we don't review the curriculum is I don't know what you're teaching in there, right?
Sure,
we don't have that experience.
Right.
We don't know what looking for XYZ in an attic is good. I don't know anything in any part about that.
Sure,
so that would be something that we would always rely on you. We guarantee that they have a curriculum, that the hours work correctly for the students, and then if there is an issue with that the student may have about not getting what they're paying for, they would come to us. They would probably come to you too. And then we would resolve that with the institution. But we do review every year, the making sure that the hours are matching what they need for licensure, for you. But if there's anything outside of that, that's where we don't have the expertise.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the parallel inspections right now are not embedded in the curriculum. It's just a separate rule requirement. So you don't know, you would have no knowledge of it because it's not embedded in the curriculum. But it would have to be part of the curriculum, actually, for it to be under this jurisdiction.
Yes.
Well, no, because right now, you can do parallels if you are approved with a school or
But it is not part of the curriculum in rules. So that's not something that Kevin or his
it's a requirement, but it's outside the curriculum.
If an institution already has that as part of their curriculum, then I don't read through the enrollment agreements to the catalogs. You know, other folks do that. It may be in there on some schools. I don't know. I doubt it, but it might be. If it is, then that's fine. Then they need to make sure that they're delivering on the number of hours that they have for classroom instruction, whether that be online or in person, and the number of what we would refer to as clinical hours, and in this case would be parallel hours.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I didn't know what parallels were until probably 24 hours ago, 14 hours ago. So now that I know that, that is something certainly I will talk to our curriculum reviewers to see what's in there. And I would be happy through a request from Judy or anybody at the board, if you want to see as part of public records, the enrollment agreements that we have and the catalogs we have with each of the institutions. You probably already have them, but if you need them, certainly it's something that we have for every institution that we license, and that is eligible through a public records request.
So you take complaints and you have your own level of enforcement for your licensees, and so if we ever wanted to check in with you on complaints against education providers for home inspection curriculum, we could check in with you on that, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Any other questions for this gentleman?
So, Judy, you were mentioning that we don't have rules right now as in the Rules Committee to establish this curriculum. Did you say that? We do have that.
What are you talking about? Just what's in has to be covered? Or
no, what I'm saying is for us to discuss and maybe go to the point where the Rules Committee looks at all these educational institutions that are providing home inspection training. We already have the authority to come up with a syllabus on our own. You agree with that? As a Rules and Standards Committee, that's one of our duties, correct?
Education.
Well, education.
Right.
So we could, theoretically, in short order, start coming up with a curriculum that we want all schools to address. Mm-hmm. You agree?
Well, we've already discussed altering the curriculum
correct.
And the number of hours, and Judy has said we have full authority to do that,
right.
I believe. So
if we can get this done, I mean, we could probably do this in a year or so.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be done as part of the rule package that we need to
no,
get on its
no,
way.
But right. That, what I'm saying is I don't think that has to be part of the rules package. We've got the authority to do that. The board would have to approve it.
The changes.
We can talk about that more, but
yeah. Oh, yeah.
It
okay.
would need to be part
you know,
of the rules.
Kevin,
a lot of
is there,
okay.
I guess, yeah, I guess one last question is there any other consideration or questions we should be asking if we're considering this kind of requirement for our education providers?
I mean, really nothing that I can think of right now. I think that's, you know, you're on a good path. You know, over the next few months, I think once you make some determinations of what you'd like to do, you know, again, keeping in mind that whatever requirements that you put in place, you know, we will certainly, we're part of that enforcement to the school side. So if you put certain requirements in and you change hours and you change things that they need to do in order to get that license, then we just need to be made aware of what those are going to be. A perfect example, I know that the Board of Nursing just did a rules change last week on Thursday or Friday. They presented us what the new rule was going to be, that it does impact our schools. And we've now already integrated that part of it, that component, into school licensure for nursing schools. So it's really kind of in your area now and what those decisions that you make. And then what we'll want to do, certainly for enforcement piece, is we'll want to make sure that our rules align with you. And, you know, again, we're kind of that enforcement piece for the schools, so we can make sure that we get that your interests represented through our board.
This is very encouraging.
Yeah, and just to be clear, we could be talking about education providers for initial licensing curriculum, along with, if we ever decided to, continuing ed education providers, correct? Could be the same providers.
It could be, that, yeah, absolutely. It would be the same provider, depending upon what you require for the curriculum. It might mean that those institutions that are currently teaching at an entry level would, they may, more than likely, they wouldn't need to be licensed for a new program. It would fall under their main licensure because there's some exemptions in our statutes for continuing ed. If you're providing, our main focus is kind of that first time out of the gate. Taking someone from knowing nothing to being able to apply those skills that you've learned at the school to a career. So more than likely they would be exempt, but we'd have to look at that. But yes, they would certainly be able to do that.
Okay, but do you manage CEs for the nursing industry here in Arizona?
No.
We do not. That's that goes through the Board of Nursing.
Okay. I don't have any other questions. Yeah.
Chairman, this is Scott Sales. I wanted to just kind of reiterate what I believe what Mr. Wells mentioned there, just at the appropriate time when that discussion needs to happen on where the continuing, where the parallel tracks need to go, to make sure that it's, you know, standardized and it's not, you know, singling out or, you know, doing anything, you know.
Yeah.
Make sure it's above, you know, make sure it's overly discussed.
Yeah, and inclusive.
Yeah, that's right. What I was looking for. So I just want to reiterate that.
Yeah.
I don't have any other questions.
Yeah, thank you for your point. Kevin, thank you so much for being here. We very much appreciate your time. And it's great that you have a direct line to Judith, and I'm sure we will be in touch. But we're kind of taking a hard look at all the education requirements here, as you can tell, and we appreciate your assistance.
I used to have a more direct line when Kevin's office was like one down from mine.
One down from you, I know. Well, thank you all very much. And if there's anything else you ever need, I will at any time come back and have a conversation with all of you. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question just about the idea? Dave Lockton and I haven't been in most of the meetings. It just sounds like, and I just want to make sure, the goal is to have any school, whether it's local or online, maybe it's AHIS or Nashi, be licensed under our state to provide that training. So if it's a local school, they probably want online, a local presence, but if it's an online school, we just want them to be licensed under our state and abide by our requirements.
Correct.
Is that right?
Well, and that for private plus secondary, so that way the student is always protected.
Correct. So like AHIT, even though they may not have an in-person presence in the state, they could abide by our rules and pay the fee or whatever if they want to provide that education for.
And a
fee
over.
So they'd have to have an in-presence, a physical presence in the state to be licensed by private plus secondary education.
Scott, you had something on that?
That's pretty loose.
Yeah, I was just going to say, well, not necessarily off topic, but one thing to keep in mind is we can't speak to legal requirements of private post-secondary. So we really can't speak to any out-of-state providers or even in-state providers as to ultimately what the requirements would be, because that's not going to be in our hands.
We don't license those entities. Right. Education.
But an interesting discussion. Interesting that they would even assist with enforcement. BTR could possibly have. Was there some
other
comment?
Only local schools can provide education for new inspectors. Like, I can get a master's degree from Harvard online or something like that, but I can't get a home inspection certificate from AHIT or education from AHIT because they don't have an in-state presence now. That would be the idea.
Nothing's been done.
No, but that would be the idea, is my what it's
the idea is to make sure everybody is covering the same topics.
Correct.
There's some of them out there that don't even talk about pool and spa.
For sure. But they'd have to have an in-state presence. It couldn't be online only from a school from like Virginia.
We can't
get into those details. Were there any other comments before we move on?
So the goal is to raise the quality of the inspectors doing the home inspections, which I think is a good thing, okay? But instead of the state now having the auspice, then you would be the one determining whether the home inspector is qualified to do parallels. Instead of the state, it would now go to whoever owns the school. Is that correct? Do I understand that correctly?
I don't understand.
No.
We're basically just trying to
set up guidelines.
Yeah, set up guidelines for everyone to meet, and try not to certainly inhibit anyone's business practices. But we definitely don't want to get in the way of anyone. But we do, you know, we're looking at all the education here, and what we're trying to address is the amount of complaints we get, and frankly, you know, we're concerned about the initial education that's provided, and who's providing it. And then, you know, we're also looking at, you know, what's the best way to protect, you know, we're here to protect our home buying consumer, and we want to have the most knowledgeable inspector that's going through that initial curriculum. But again, we're going to be looking at the curriculum anyway, right, Keith?
Yeah.
So it all kind of could fit together.
It could, yeah.
It could fit together. So unless there's anything else on this topic, we are going to move on. Thank you all. Time well spent. Thank you, Judith, for coordinating this.
It was, good.
Perfect timing to have this discussion.
Good starting point.
Let's see. Anybody really need a break here? We're going to move on. We'll take a break within 30 to 45 minutes for a quick pit stop. But let's move on with the agenda to item 5A as an able comments regarding the proposed rule changes, specifically the standard of practice changes for home inspectors. So we need to just go through final changes, and thank you, Hayden, for bringing that up. And if you can just scribe some notes on what we do try to, as far as changes on here. So thank you for capturing that. You're way better at that than I am.
As far as additional comments that came in, and I know it's there's a lot of information here in our handout, and keep in mind there is a tabs on the side to find things, but as far as additional comments that came in, there weren't really that much for additional things that I recall beyond what we discussed last time, which we need to go through. But if there's something new that came in since we met last, please remind me if it's something pertinent.
I think we had three comments.
In the GFIs, right. Yeah, well, so...
Chairman, yeah. This is Scott Sales. I've looked through the information there. We have a lot of comments. So these all just came in from other
inspectors
sending them in.
Right.
And so the intent of this 5A is to kind of go through some of those and see if they should be
correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Make sure.
Yeah.
And I can clarify some more as well. Okay. So as you know, we had a proposed rulemaking put out. We had a 90-day period for a public comment. Sent out three mass emails plus letters out to the community for public comment. We received public comments, and what we basically have in this packet are the public comments that we received. Okay. And so what this committee is looking at right now is, after reviewing these comments, do we want to update the SOP as it stands based on those comments? And if so, if we're updating these SOPs, that would probably require a supplemental rule package, which again would go through the whole process of another public comment period, and basically doing everything over again, but with new changes. As we have right now, we have, I think, a November 17th, 2023 AZ-ASHI version that was in the proposed rulemaking. If this were to change, this SOP, AZ-ASHI would have to adopt those, get a new date, and then we would have to put that into the supplemental rulemaking in order to have that those changes show.
Okay.
If no changes are made to the SOP, then the November 17th would probably just stand as is. And then the board would make any final determination. This is just a comment period for this committee to give to the board, and the board will then make the decision as to whether a supplemental rulemaking needs to be opened.
Yeah. And this is Roger Spence. I'll speak to that. The standards of practice that were submitted to the board, unfortunately, we're not the very last version. It went through somehow. I don't know how, but it did. And so if we're going to make any changes and bring it, update it to the December standards, we're still going to have to do submit the new rule.
A supplemental.
The supplemental rule anyway.
So you got to do it anyway.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
Okay. Yep.
Okay.
So we're going to have to run it through the chapter and the supplemental package either way, even if we don't make changes here. Right. Yeah.
And I've had full support of any rules, changes that have been made here by our board, by the Arizona National Board, and full support. So we can move on, with the new and with the anticipation that we're going to submit the supplemental rule package at some point.
Mr. Chairman,
yep.
Do any of the people here, do they have concerns about, do they want to talk about what their concerns are?
I do not know.
Oh.
I do not know.
Because our signs were a little bit off, so I didn't know if any of you were here for public comment and missed that because we are
signs. Those at the very beginning?
Yeah.
Like public comment just about anything?
Usually it's to bring forth something that you would like to have discussed at a future meeting.
I missed those. We were sitting more toward the middle, locked in, and just thought, we heard you guys, but I assumed you were all going to come over there at night. And I didn't see
those. I had the same assumption, but somebody in Alpha's brought me around here. So.
I had a couple of stuff, and since I'm already chatting, I'll go. Just recently, I was looking at stuff, and I knew we were changing these, and I totally forgot about this. And maybe this could be in the future. But recently a builder contacted my company, you signed the builder agreement, you're going to do this and do that. But one of their things was, and you're going to provide me a copy of the report. And so I know I'm not going to. And so I looked in our standards, and our standards say we provide the client a copy of the report, but it doesn't say who we don't provide a copy of the report. And I looked through some other stuff. I called, and there is nothing that says who we can't provide it to. And so, you know, I know in the NHIE books, the part of the ethics, I read that, and it says we only provide it to the client. So in the AC standards, in the prep, in the SOP, or in anything else, there's nothing that states what we can do with the report. It says we have to give it to the client, but it doesn't say anything else about what we can't do with it, who we can't give it to, if we can put it online. There's no rules regarding that. So I think
I'm going to have to look that up.
No, that's a business decision.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's an ethics.
Hold on. The attorney's going to stand up. Everybody stop.
This is under call to the public, so there cannot be any discussion or comment by the public. It can be agendized for a future meeting, though.
Got it. Okay, so we can't dig down into
that's
this.
Fine.
Do you have anything pertinent to the SOP specifically that you'd like to bring up?
To me, it was missing that we saying, because there's a lot of we don't do this, and to me it was missing that we don't give it to certain places, because NHIE, which is provided by ASHI, gives ethics that says we don't do this. As a home inspector, you only give it to a client, that's it. So that was something I thought was kind of missing. The only other thing I want to bring up was we have to do a DPS fingerprint clearance card. I was looking at mine the other day. It's only good for 6 years. It's not expired, but there's probably lots of home inspectors who have expired fingerprint clearance cards. And my company, we're like, wow, we're probably going to start checking every year, you know, a background check every year for our own employees, because maybe they get a DUI, and I trust all the guys now, but maybe we have more guys in the future. We don't know everybody. And same thing, you hire that inspector, and they have a felony now because of whatever reason, and you just don't know. So we have to provide insurance every year. I would think we have to provide proof of a current fingerprint clearance card as well.
And we are talking about that, and on the renewal process right now, you guys do check anyway.
Not fingerprint clearance card.
We don't check the fingerprint clearance card. We do a background check.
So you guys are going off topic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we have had that discussion as well.
Yeah.
All right, so we are on the SOPs here, and let's get our head into these for a few minutes. I'll hit a couple of the proposed changes. We will need to finalize the wording that we'll probably need Hayden for, and
I got it, actually, Paul.
Thank you. You're on it.
I did.
And
so what I have,
and I've got about five or six discussion topics here, just to see if we're all on the same page. And I also want to hit the GFIs one last time to make sure that we're. This is kind of the trying to put a bow in the standards here and trying to finalize and kind of lock these in. Since we are finally done with our public comment period.
Chairman, so what's just for, what do we got up on the screen?
So we have the standards of practice, the
version,
I don't know, the draft of changes is probably what we have.
That's the latest version, 3.0.
So yeah.
That's it.
Basically what was presented to the public, I think that was like version 2.0, whatever, but that was the November 17th AZ-ASHI standards. So what we have here at the last meeting, they had looked at public comments up to that point. We did receive a couple more after that meeting. But from that meeting, they had included some changes based off of that. Let me scroll on down here. It's the itty-bitty desk of mine.
So the red text in here
is from
this committee or from the public?
It's kind of a mix.
Well, mostly
from the public through the committee,
okay, right? Correct. It all came through the committee, so. So let's just look at this one for a moment here and just refresh our discussion from last week. I don't think we need to take any action on it. I think we're going to be leaving it as it is. But as we discussed, getting into the jurisdiction concern for the high-rise condos, that they are not currently within the definition that is in statute for a home inspection, but we've at least addressed the concern in the home inspection SOPs for defining the type of housing and units that are under the jurisdiction of a home inspection. The discussion, again, with the definition that's in statute, we're going to have to live with that until, at some point in some future time, a bill is run and
And I'm saying that now because I'm not going to be around, but somebody else on this table will. And next time the bill is run, going to need to look at the statute on the definition of a home inspection. But for now, it is what it is. We've had our standards, the current standards, for 22, 23 years, and we are the definition and understanding of the application of the buildings we're looking at has changed a little bit at the BTR, where they're not allowing high-rise condos as part of the parallel inspections anymore. If those aren't being allowed as far as on the parallel inspections, then they should have no jurisdiction whatsoever right now, even to the point of accepting a complaint against an inspector who did a high-rise condo. Technically, if there's a complaint that came in against an inspector that did a high-rise condo, we probably should not be processing it, because it's not clear that there's any jurisdiction.
I agree.
So Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Question for you. This 3.1B with the red, is that what we're considering to be the change that we're going to implement, or is that simply a point of discussion for this committee?
That is the change that we're looking to implement.
In the new version?
Correct.
So here would be my comment. We're stating as a single-family dwelling and individual dwelling units in a multi-unit building, along with their garages or carports.
Yep.
The confusion that I have is, I'm sure everybody in this room who's a practicing inspector like me would say, so what you're stating to me is that now I have to inspect a common garage that is part of a multi-unit building.
Their garages or carports.
Well, but...
So you're inferring that you have to inspect the whole parking garage here?
That's very unclear to me in reading this first time through. I think we need to make clarification and say garages that are specific to that particular...
It says there.
I'm just stating to you that if all of us, I'm sure in this room, have inspected condos and high rises. It's unclear the way that this is written, if we're really going to wordsmith this, what that actually means when we state in a multi-unit building along with their garages or carports. Their garages, to me, the implicit statement there is, it's a garage that's tied to that particular unit.
Mm-hmm.
That unit doesn't have its own individual garage. It's not a townhouse with a garage downstairs, which of course you would inspect. In this instance, I would say the standards are stating that we have to inspect the entire garage.
I would say they have to inspect the parking space assigned to that unit. That's how I would see that. But, you know, Roger, we discussed this, of course, in detail.
And this is what did not get submitted in the December submission.
That's why I think you ought to leave it the same, the way it was.
Couldn't you just add an exclusion for shared parking structures?
Could we just take the along with their garages and carports and put it right after single family dwelling and then have a comma and individual dwelling units in a multi-unit building?
There you go. If that helps to clarify, there's no way we want the inspector responsible for anything they shouldn't be, right?
That would be my point.
We would never want them to have to buy the whole garage. And I think this inference is just for the parking space, though. Should the inspector be looking at the parking space assigned to Unit 2C? I'm asking.
No.
I don't think so. Because I think you're opening yourself up to a whole can of worms about leaching out of lime from the space, from the concrete above it. And now you're getting into a rolling ball down a hill that you can't stop. But
plus, it's an HOA matter.
Exactly.
It's a
exactly.
Because I have a question, Mr. Donaldson, on whether it comes to garages or carports. If they have both, does that still apply?
Ultimately, that answer would be provided by the board regarding the situation at the time.
Well,
It does say and, so you would think that it that would
work. But it says garages or carports.
Could be and or.
Yeah.
What you're saying. God, you're good.
You know, we were trying to keep this as the simplest, lowest common denominator, and try not to have a whole bunch of exclusions on this and keep it clean, but not leave a loophole, right? That was the whole idea, and that's what we're trying to accomplish here. I honestly, Roger, I was never a big fan of the garages and carports, but it seemed like the chapter wanted to have it in there as the to have some responsibility for the inspectors, but
it's knowing they comply with parallel process as well. When that comes into play as well,
you know, the parallels.
You know, with parallels, when, you know, the parallels, when I'm inspecting garages, but we need to specify if that particular unit has a garage or a carport.
How are other shared systems dealt with? Central HVAC systems, central boilers, that sort of thing.
Whatever components are housed within the unit is what you look at, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from the home inspector's side of things, doesn't matter if they're attached or detached. The garages are perfect.
I mean, that gets to a business decision. I like looking at anything that is part of the purchase agreement. Whatever they're buying, if they're buying a storage space in the basement, I want to look at it for. So, you know,
should we add and or?
If we need to clarify it, but
I mean, it doesn't hurt, right?
It doesn't hurt.
Where would you like to
the chances of having a carport and a garage?
Are
there's not a whole lot of those around. Mm-hmm. And we could do and or. Let's just see how this reads now. Standard buildings, single family dwelling, along with their garages and or carports, and dwelling units in a multi unit building.
Period.
Right, which removes the obligation to do garages in a multi-unit building.
Yeah.
It's not that, and that's what I think we're trying to say.
We can have that be a business decision, you know? No one's saying you can't do it.
Yeah.
No one's saying you could go down and inspect the entire garage if you want.
Yeah. Right, right.
And add that.
Oh, absolutely.
The whole garage.
All
right, good.
But just to get back to a moment, where I think Scott may have had something to say. And this gets back to jurisdiction right now, where we stand before these pass, on if there's a complaint that comes in on a high-rise condo, is there jurisdiction? Scott, have any feel?
That would be a question that the board would have to answer, honestly.
That's the board. Okay.
Four units or less right now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in statute,
right? Yeah, and my reason for mentioning that it is, I just want us to be consistent, Judith. If we're not allowing these to be parallels, then they shouldn't be part of the regulatory body at all, and we shouldn't even accept a complaint.
Just to clarify, any complaint that comes into the board is accepted and processed.
Oh, right, until you figure out what it is. Right, right.
No, but the whole reason why you took this out of the parallel process is you were seeing so many that were done in a high rise or multi-family units, right?
We took it out because of what it says in statute. I mean, and if anybody really wants to argue that or push that, we put it before the board.
Yeah. Let me ask you one thing. Forgetting the definition for a moment, if someone produces a report that says home inspection on it, is there jurisdiction? In Arizona, there's a report produced that says home inspection. By virtue of that alone, is there jurisdiction?
No.
You have to have an inspection agreement assigned with that report.
But
the two together.
It's a tough question,
well,
Scott.
Well, no,
but it does get to a reasonable.
Well, the problem is that nobody in this room can answer that question. Mm-hmm. Only the board sitting when a complaint goes through the investigation process and gets to the board, and the board then has it agendized properly for review, discussion, and possible legal action, they will then look at the circumstances and the law in place at that time and decide whether or not there is jurisdiction and whether or not there's been a violation. Nobody else can answer that question. Not even the presently sitting board can answer it for what's going to happen a month from now.
Okay.
So.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, I have one more comment on B, just to
go right ahead.
So we're talking about, does this cover the instance where, say, a company comes in and wants to buy a whole condo complex that has an underground parking and
mm-hmm.
everything like that? So
mm-hmm.
does this
would just say, okay, the home inspector is required to do all the inspection for the rooms and everything, but when it goes to, say, the basement with all the parking stalls, since it's a multi-unit building, they don't have to inspect down below?
We don't want these standards to apply to any commercial multi-unit building.
Okay, all right.
That's not what they're built for. It's not built for the commercial multi-unit. It's really down to the individual dwelling unit. That's what we're all about. We're not in commercial land at all here. But it's a good point. There's no jurisdiction there at all then.
I was whispering that question to
him. All right, any other comments? Can we live with 3.1b here?
Yeah.
The standard applicable to completed buildings as a single family dwelling, along with their garages and or carports and individual dwelling units in a multi-unit building. So the last piece was meant to help address that high rise. Everything else is a clarification. And we're not requiring carports or garages. I got a single family house and I've got a detached garage. Is that not included?
That's what I thought about.
Specified.
You think you say carports and or garages, you would think it has a carport, it has a separate detached garage, but again, I think that is a business decision. Anything detached doesn't count. We just do it, but
if you get an extra $50.
Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but you know.
But that brings up that question though. The detached garage and a single family. Let's ask now, is it required now? Is it required now in our current standards to inspect that detached garage?
Or what about detached?
What's
Scott
going to say?
It doesn't.
Or we have garages in there.
Right. But there's no requirement to inspect all the buildings on the property, right? Just the dwelling.
What it says currently, Mr. Chairman, in 5.3 on page 2, the inspector is not required to observe outbuildings other than garages and carports.
Thank you. All right, so they're locked in the garages and cars. Okay, I want to make sure we're not stepping on that. So, that being the case,
that's good.
Then that's good the way it is.
Yeah.
All right, just making sure. I think we're good on that. Let us move on to, I think, 5.2 Baker. Kurt might be the next one. Hang on. So this was a wording thing, right? And this was, David had a good recommendation on adjusting the wording.
Just
on
sentence
there.
Structure. Yeah.
Right. So operate the representative number of windows and all entry doors. So keep the windows on one side and the doors on the other end of
that's good.
Sentence, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I think that's good, right?
Yeah, we laid the list.
All right. I think that's good.
After door should have a comma.
That's true. Doors including.
Okay.
I think our next one, Kurt, might be 8.1.I, and this is one where I wanted to
create confusion.
What are your thoughts?
I brought that up because it's unclear, you know, what it really gets into code if you're going to leave it in. It's applicable. Depending on the time of the build and
the
city and all
just
these things.
Just report on it if it's there or not.
Yeah, you know, we do have some other areas as required, when required.
This is a new one, carbon monoxide, and it's been.
Right.
It's just. It doesn't. It's more confusing than less confusing.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
It's just simply whether it's present or absent, and
exactly.
It's perfect.
Exactly.
So the where applicable is not really doing anything for us.
That was to refer to, you know, there's some homes that you don't need to have a carbon monoxide alarm.
You say it's
all, all electric house without a garage doesn't need one.
Yeah, I will tell you that there were a number of several feedback from public comments that said we should detail when there's gas appliances, attached garage, when just detail when the COs are required. Again, that is a code thing, and that could change. But we're hesitant to start going into code land and saying that either, you know, with fossil fuel burning or attached garages that start to detail that.
There's a debate over an attached garage with a vehicle in there could transmit carbon monoxide into the home.
Right.
That's, you know, in our world, that's not cleared up.
If it's running, if someone, you know, forgets to turn it off and then roll it in, take the groceries out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People have died. Yeah,
so the where
the whole house with carbon monoxide. Unintended, but it happened.
Yeah. All right. So I think we're all okay with removing where applicable.
Great.
But if we remove,
it puts the more responsibility on the inspector for them to know what the heck they're doing and when they're applicable or not.
Okay. The example was, remember, vapor barriers is only required in areas of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Where the climate requires vapor barriers.
Right.
So it's the exact same thing. You must report on vapor barriers, but you can add a sentence that says, you know, in this particular area or in this home, a carbon monoxide alarm may not be required or is not required if you want to take that stamp. So that was the other part of the discussion we had.
The only comment that I would make here is that this, back to those of us who are practicing inspectors, this creates complexity in the sense that, you know, as the technology is changing, there's a lot of combination alarm systems now. There's a lot of smoke alarms that are combined with carbon monoxide alarms. And what we do is basically we have to go in and now we have to state presence or absence of carbon monoxide.
Right.
So pretty much in every instance, we're going to be stating, and just talking about our company, we're going to be stating that we don't know. We can't determine because we're not going to go up there and pull it apart.
Right.
If it's connected to a central alarm system, obviously, you know, everybody here that's an inspector knows what I'm talking about. And so the only thing I would state here is we're establishing that we need to focus on presence or absence, but I think most of us are going to state, unless we see it and we know it's a carbon monoxide, we're going to have to state we don't know whether or not it's there.
That's true. That unable to verify if they're combo smoky COs.
Yeah,
and it's
right.
I can't see it way up, and especially vaulted ceilings, there's no
exactly.
way to see that. And that's well, way beyond our scope. Again, that is going to need to be a business decision, but at least it's a mention that the buyer knows that you were not able to verify it. I was not able to verify.
Right.
There's a smoky there. I can't verify it's a CO. You should verify. You have CO
that's
protection. And that's the best we can do
right.
as an inspector.
And that's what we put in our reports, basically.
Yep.
I hate to be nebulous because that's not what we are as a profession, but I think in this instance we have to be.
Well, I think we have to. But sometimes, John, we see the plug-in. You know, we see
exactly.
it's an obvious, or we can tell it's a standalone CO detector.
Yep.
But
okay.
there's a lot of times we have to have the disclaimer saying we can't tell, but you better check.
Yep.
That's absolutely right.
As long, you know, from a consumer perspective, as
yep.
long as you're reporting on it either way, I'm seeing it now going, oh, carbon monoxide, maybe do we need that? Should I check on that? Maybe I should check if that thing is or whatever. I mean, you know, it's kind of an alert for
mm-hmm.
John.
Yeah, this is so important.
You reported
safety.
On it either way.
You know, there are a few things more important, frankly, for the home inspector than these kind of smoke detectors and CO devices. Too many people die in homes, the inspector has to be up on these super important safety items. It's a primary part of their job and their standard of care, for that matter.
So, Mr. Chairman,
yep.
do we need H and I then? Can we combine H and I into one
and
get rid of I and just have H?
And or?
Because we might have, I don't know. We could put them on the same line, you know, obviously the reason why they're on two lines is because how the codes came in, right? and how we adopted
too,
them.
Because if you say and or you just negated one doesn't even matter now. So if they're on two,
I don't know. I kind of like them separate. Yeah. I still kind of like them separate. It's
we're just talking about this. That's all.
It's less dangerous. Yeah. For the reasons I stated, how important the safety is. If they're separate, maybe they'll get noticed more. And plus, as we're building the curriculum, they'll have separate little denotations on those important safety items in the curriculum. So we won't be grouping them together. Thinking ahead here. All right. I think that's it on the COs. Any other comments?
As we look to the future with all the new technology out there, are you all seeing other things now that are popping? Not smoke alarms or carbon monoxide, but like things you get pretty fancy with cameras and other built-ins to the house that are now, can't take them out anymore.
Yeah, we've disclaimed all that.
Thermostats, you don't know which way to turn them.
Right.
And all of a sudden it blows up the...
Yeah, we have disclaimed all the low voltage.
It's a unit because you messed with the control.
Nest thermostat.
Yeah, Nest.
Yes. I'm just bringing some of the stuff up from the outside.
No, it's fine. That's clearly, clearly disclaimed that we just don't do any of the low voltage. Okay. We don't really do any low volt.
Okay.
That's really it.
I do another 50.
That we are required to do. I think that's this one. Let's move on. What do we have? All right.
Bedroom.
Yeah, let's go to 11.2C one last time. This was our stretch for us, folks, honestly. No other SOP has this in there that I've seen. And I think it's good. I like it. And by the way, ASHI's standard practice committee is probably going to be, by the end of the year, we won't see what their draft is, but by the end of the year, they're redrafting new national standards. Some of what we have, I'm sure, the kitchen appliances, the things we have, some of that, certainly our AFCIs and COs, that's obviously going to be in the new ASHI ones. But just to let you know where ASHI National is, they're just in the process of delivering a draft by the end of the year to the ASHI board. And so I'll be keeping you guys up to speed on that. But again, we'll be putting a stake in the ground before that. But I still feel good about where we're at. And
any bedrooms, I like it.
Yeah. And, we got into the discussion, David, of rooms meant for sleeping, right? I mean, you could have a cot in the dining room and there's no fire egress window. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about rooms meant for the purpose of sleeping. Right?
How about changing it to sleeping rooms?
Is there a definition for what a sleeping room is?
There's more of a definition for a bedroom. That's a standard accepted, so accepted universally that sleeping room sounds like it could be something
some
else.
Some standard somewhere it says sleeping room.
Yeah, the other thing is bedroom is all over the code. It's all over the code. Why not stay consistent, right?
And we really spent a lot of time on this at the last meeting, and that's where we landed.
You could always add the word from bedrooms and glossary of rooms.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of
clarification
since I was on one track. Yeah.
All right. So let's take the last couple of comments on this here.
If I may, Mr. Chair, just we do have to make sure that the conversation is kept to one person speaking at a time because this is being audio recorded and transmitted as well. So we have to make sure all conversations for open meeting law purposes take place.
Thank you, Scott. I know there's a lot of energy in the room right now. Yeah, Kurt.
I just need clarification. So front bedrooms is already in there. The comment was possibly removed from bedrooms since the secondary egress definition has bedroom already in it.
Well, let's look at that def for a second. Yeah. That's secondary fire egress from bedrooms. So bedrooms are in the definition. So we're definitely... So they're in the definition, so the point is, do we need them in there if they're already in the def, right? That's the question.
Right.
For secondary fire egress, addresses bedrooms. So maybe we don't need from bedrooms in there. Is that serving us if we kept from bedrooms in the fire egress?
Well, it's just adding clarity to it. Mm-hmm. But we might want to consider basements, though.
Right? I don't know. I don't want to create confusion. we want the inspectors to know we're looking at bedroom fire egress. And if we remove bedroom from the body of it, I'm concerned that there might be a little more confusion.
I agree.
No, we ought to.
We want to be as clear as possible on these. We really do, both for the education providers and for the inspectors. So it's not hurting anything by keeping bedrooms in there. So let's go back up there, Kurt.
I agree, but don't you
add
basement? Why not?
But I guess the question is, if we say from bedrooms, are we limiting anything here? Yeah.
Right. So let's say you're inspecting a house that's currently got an office, but it could be used as a bedroom. Is that something that, you know, you would need to consider? So if a room could be used as a bedroom, it should have secondary.
Yeah. And that's kind of on the inspector to know that this looks and smells like it could go either way, a study or a bedroom.
Right.
You better inspect it like a bedroom.
But
we do know that sometimes the listing agents call things bedrooms that are not legal bedrooms. We find that all the time. The comments?
My comment is that if you start to get into the real nitty-gritty of secondary fire egress and you're not defining it as it relates to a bedroom, now
it's
you
open.
Go back
it's
to Keith's comment about basements. And you can also go through, and there's plenty of places in Illinois where I come from where there are bedrooms in basements.
Right.
Yeah. So now you've got that real complexity there about, okay, is this even considered a bedroom to begin with since they don't have
closets? That's like the cot in the dining room, John, isn't it?
Exactly.
Right. You could put a bed anywhere. I mean, the bed is the family room couch tonight. That's the bed, right?
I hate to make it so inclusive for inspectors that we have to identify secondary fire egress throughout the house.
That would be
problematic.
What a mess,
I think. Yeah.
Now I think we leave in from bedrooms, right?
It's, but I think that wasn't Keith's point, though. I don't think.
No, right? It isn't. I mean, you've got a basement. Hey, it doesn't have to be a bedroom to have
right.
a fire hazard. You can't get out. You've got to. I don't see too many basements.
Right, I know, but that's still up to the inspector to say, hey, somebody's sleeping here. I better make a call. It looks like somebody's been sleeping here and it's not a bedroom. That should be a call for the inspector, right?
It doesn't need to be a bedroom, is what I'm saying.
Right.
I mean, there should be a way out of there and there's got to be another way out.
So you're saying we shouldn't have from bedrooms in there because it's limiting?
Okay. Read that and say. And
add
basements.
Yeah. And add basements? That's what you're saying? Mm. Now that opens up another can. Another can of worms right there.
That's being too specific.
Yeah.
I agree. I actually think that's a public service.
Why is it being too specific to say and basement? You're not taking bedrooms out.
Now you got the whole basement.
And basement.
Now you got fire egress for the whole basement. You don't know if it's chopped up in the rooms. I don't know. It's just too many things up in the air.
But I would maintain that in terms of basements, and I don't want to take us off on a long tangent, but I would maintain in terms of basements that we have an obligation to establish that if you have a window well, you have an escape, you know, you have an escape point with a ladder. You've got to be able to get out the window. The window's got to be able to open. It can't be a casement window, right? We could go on and on and on and on. I would maintain that from the standpoint of the public interest, we should be identifying secondary fire egress in basements because that's a true fire hazard.
And if there's a bedroom in the basement, like you suggested,
then
it falls in anyway.
I understand,
One point to keep in mind, if you do add hand basements to the end of that, you will have to change your definition of secondary fire egress to remove.
It's going to get really murky. Go ahead.
As an experienced home inspector, we make these kinds of judgment calls anyway, so you're giving us great guidelines. I understand it. As I'm listening to this, this is a tough job. I didn't realize how tough this was for you guys. But as experienced home inspectors, you got to make a decision on your experience.
Right.
No matter what the verbiage is.
Yep. We know bedrooms in the basements. We have to inspect those as bedrooms anyway, wherever they're at. They could be on the roof. If it's a bedroom, we got to inspect it. So I don't know. I don't think we're losing much by not putting basements in there. It's still under the responsibility of the inspector who's inspecting that basement for everybody's safety. Any other comments?
So it's whether you want to have it in a standard or just hope that someone has
good education.
Education, experience, and practice.
To know that somebody could be sleeping in a basement and wasn't meant for that. Yeah, that's on us,
it's
right?
It's not necessarily just sleeping. You've got to get out. What if you're down there? I mean, old construction, I'm from Michigan, man, you couldn't get out of the basement.
Right.
It was a fire trap.
All right, no, I know. You had one stairway up, that was it.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
You had to go through
and
the kitchen.
Casement windows.
No,
exactly.
But you're never opening.
Yeah,
and
right. Okay, just one person here. Go right ahead.
My thought would just be, there's lots of places that need egress. An office, that just anywhere you're sleeping in should have some sort of egress. But we can't put in wherever somebody might be sleeping. They might be sleeping in a living room with a deadbolt on the windows and a deadbolt on the doors. It's key deadbolt. So we do report on key egress, but you can't report where everyone's sleeping. So I would say if it's a code thing, and whatever, we're not co-inspectors, but if it's a code thing for basements to have egress,
it is.
Sure. Then maybe that is something we should be reporting on. It's not code necessarily for a living room to have egress. So if it's code for bedrooms to have egress, which it is, and basements, which it seems to be, maybe that should be included, but we can't just decide where everyone's going to be sleeping. So I think we should defer to some code at that point, even though we don't put it in.
So it's up to the inspector and their knowledge. Yeah.
I'm saying it's up to, if we're going to put it in the standards, as long as it's a code, because you don't want to say, oh, this builder didn't put key egress downstairs and it's not code. Oh, well, your builder's an idiot. No, you want to at least defer to code on those.
Yeah, I don't know that we're going to be harming anyone by not putting in basements.
All right.
I kind of like it the way it is. Unless someone feels strongly about 11.2c, I think we should go with it the way it is right now. Inspector shall report the absence of secondary fire egress from bedrooms.
Period.
And that's to allow them to get out and allow the fire department to come in and help them.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, by doubling up four bedrooms, we've got bedrooms here and then also down the definition.
Depth,
really
right.
Kind of, to me, says this is for bedrooms and not anything, since you're doubling up on it. That's just my...
Just as a reminder of the last meeting, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but there was a discussion where we referred back to what Webster's dictionary, how it defined a bedroom. And
right.
So that was, and I read it last meeting, was
it meant for sleeping.
A room furnished with a bed and intended primarily for sleeping. So if you're doing an occupied home and it's got a bed in it at that time, you're going to have to report, check for egress for sure. If it's questionable, you're going to have to make a business decision, I would think,
I don't see I have any issue with bedrooms in both places, though.
Just throwing out my thing.
If nothing else, I think it clarifies what we're asking the inspector to do. And we're supporting it, too, in definitions. It is a new thing, so let's have it in both areas. This is going to be a training thing for all home inspectors when these go through, that now this is required as part of the law. All right.
You're going to have to design the definition. Right? Is that what you're talking about doing?
No, we like the definition the way it is for secondary fire egress, right?
Okay.
It has bedrooms in there.
To not define in the glossary what a bedroom is.
No, because that's a universally accepted,
perfect.
Right? You just read that from Mr. Webster. So
Mr. Webster's
right.
Great.
You know, what Mr. Webster says doesn't really matter if it's not
right.
The standards of practice or our laws and rules. Just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we don't need every single word in our glossary, like window and door and every other rest of the words we're using here. Common knowledge by the layperson, right? By the layperson, who's usually our consumer. All right, that's 11.2c. Let's go back up to 8, Kurt. Let's just go up to GFIs one last time. Yeah, I know. One more time with feeling. Let's look at this here. So, shall observe and operate readily accessible GFIs. There's been a couple of last comments that have come in during the public comment period that say we should not be hitting these darn test buttons and dropping the circuit. I've spoken against it. I don't like testing these. It's more important in some areas than others. You could say it's more important in the kitchen and bathrooms than it might be
in a carport or garage or something, or exterior. But the challenge is for the inspector. We are required by law right now to test them, to hit the test button. They often, they sometimes can break, and so we have to own them. But the bigger issue, besides having to test a mechanical device like this, which hasn't been touched in years, is dropping a circuit, turning a circuit off, disabling an entire circuit. And we have no idea what's on that circuit. And for those purposes, we said, you know, for those same reasons, we said we shouldn't be tripping AFCI breakers because we don't want to drop the whole circuit. I still think testing GFIs is fraught with danger. There's only more and more devices and internet devices and everything else that are on that circuit. And right now, we're required to test the mechanical device, not the downstream or tributary devices that are daisy chained to it. But I still think that should be the inspector's call. But let's do one last discussion on this. It was firsthand.
You may have just answered that inspector's call because the buyers are going to stand there and say, you check those, right?
Right.
They're safe, right?
Right. And it's up to the inspector. And some you're going to feel comfortable with testing, but we've all done it. You hit the test button, and it trips somewhere else in the house, and now you're on an adventure trying to find it.
Well, we need a definitive statement from you that we can, I guess, shield ourselves from the buyers and say, hey, outside the scope.
Yeah, and again, you don't need it from us. Keep in mind, you could always say, I did not test the GFIs because of XYZ. You could always put that in a report,
sure.
Right? That's always an option for you.
Right.
But you better have a good reason why you didn't, if it's required in here.
Right.
Our job is
you can just say, just saying it was occupied may not be enough. I don't know.
I understand.
Maybe it is.
Right.
Our job is to protect the public, I think it's written. I think it's perfect.
You like it the way it is because you think it's that
and
important.
And I've had to replace GFIs because you press the button, goes off.
Right.
That's just.
Yeah, I've been doing this so many years. I actually know how when I hit the button and the button shoots out over the room. You know, I measure how long the button shoots out. My personal best is 10.5 feet.
Oh, I got you beat.
But it is an important safety device, and the challenge is, and frankly, Peter Leeds brought this up too earlier this year, where we know the bathrooms and kitchens right next to the sinks, those are the most important, and if we don't require it, they're not going to hit those, and they're just going to disclaim them all, and that's going to be the indication, and that's the fear of not requiring it.
Mr. Chairman, I have a thought too, because I've purchased a few freezer full of elk.
Oh yeah.
As a result of this, because people will plug in to the garage outlet, their freezers and refrigerators, and by exercising the device, those motors kicking on for those appliances can make those immediately after we leave trip off as soon as they turn back on. So it just dawned on me, just as an idea, what if we said you must operate them if the home is vacant or absent of possessions.
Yeah.
Because when there's possessions in, now the garage becomes problematic.
I think we've all had the refrigerator where we didn't reset it. I mean, I've had to replace stuff too. But I think we've learned as seasoned inspectors, you know, we're going to find that stuff. Or before you do the GFIs, you're going to check the garage.
You disclaim on it.
Or you disclaim on it. You can disclaim on it.
I'm unwilling to risk it.
I mean, it is a thought on a vacant home. That gets a little bit subjective. You know, as a business practice, I want to, if I have a vacant home, I want to drop all
you're
the arcs too. I'm going to check all the AFCIs. I'm going to drop the whole bank of AFCIs if it's a vacant home. That's just a business practice. It's not required. But
so I think it looks good. Does that mean that you only have to check the device that has the two buttons, right? And all other connected load to that does not have to be verified?
By the term of device.
Exactly.
Device.
That's how we've always interpreted it in the past. If that device has two buttons and you can get to it, you're going to test that device, but you do not have to verify connected load to that.
Anything else is a business decision.
Yeah.
You don't have to verify that it dropped
right.
the tributary outlets.
Yeah.
You just need to verify that it dropped that outlet that has the device in it.
However,
and that could be a breaker, right? That could be a breaker.
If you're in the kitchen, you're gonna hit that. You're gonna test those other ones anyways because they should.
Of course, you are as a good practicing home inspector, you're not required.
Yeah.
You know.
So the way that this is written now, it's saying that we're required to test all GFI devices.
Correct.
How does that same logic not also apply to arc faults and breakers themselves? But
mostly because that. The nature of it and the arc faults were more for arcing and sparking on these 15 amp circuits. It had nothing to do with water and wet areas, and so it was just a little different type of circuit protection, I guess.
Well, arc faults, when they were originally designed, that was for a major defect, right? So GFCIs were always designed for the use of inhabitants in a home. Whereas arc faults were never designed for that purpose, and I think we could distinguish
for fires.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. So.
Yep. Yep. Fire hazard. That's a good point.
So you're basically we're coming to the conclusion that defective GFIs are more of a safety concern than defective arc faults or breakers themselves.
That's what the standards are telling us here, and the question is, are we okay with that? Because maybe they are more important. The first GFI was that underwater pool light. Gee, that seemed like it was important at the time, and now it's real important. So I realize we're dealing with these two different ways, and in some ways I'd like to group them together and deal with them both the same and not require it, but it's important safety devices. And usually they're so easy for us to check. We're right there at the sink, boom, boom, boom. 98% of the time it's super easy for us.
Yeah.
So I'm okay leaving them in, but this is our last ditch effort here because we got to live with these for the next many years. Yeah.
I'm okay dealing with the sink. Similar, I just don't, if there's a plugged-in refrigerator and freezer and then the GFCI is over here, the button, I know I'm going to trip it. If it doesn't go back on, I have to go get an extension cord, plug those in. And I'm prepared to do that. But are all home inspected, and we prepared to do that? Do I even remember? And maybe it shuts off. Maybe it breaks the refrigerator freezer. For some reason, it breaks. Now you can't plug it in at all.
Right.
And so, I mean, we in general, I'm not going to pay for a GFC. I'm going to make the homeowner pay for it. But they're going to be pretty pissed if their refrigerator freezer doesn't work anymore.
Absolutely. And it's not our fault, but it's our responsibility, right?
I've never had that.
I know. Neither have I.
Yeah, but we always have the option to say we did not test a GFI
exactly.
Because the garage had a lot of personal items. We always have that option, right, as a home inspector. To be clear, saying we did not check the garage and exterior GFIs because of the amount of personal items in the garage.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair statement to put in a home inspection report. Because I didn't want to pay for a freezer or a belt.
Notice that he had a full
the
freezer.
Absence would be new. Now that we have to report they're not there. Right now we just have to report if there's AFCIs or GFCIs. I report they are there, but I don't report they're not there.
You don't?
No, I don't.
Oh,
I just looked at our SOP. That part, the presence or absence, that's not there.
And just to clarify, these are just based off of the last version of the standards and then the updates to those standards, not the original now standing standards.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure if the current one said absence or not.
Okay,
it's a good point, but we need to note the absence. If we don't have GFIs and kitchen baths and exterior, we need to note it.
For sure. I noticed that, so I'm going to have to change the report. But online, at least right now, that's not in the one I got off
in
the website.
In 2003.
Correct. Absence, that's true. That may not be in there.
So
it may not be in there. But you can always recommend upgrades on the old one, right?
For sure, yeah.
Does that nomenclature then imply that you must compare the home to current GFCI location requirements? Because absence within any location that should have it must be reported if it appears.
That's correct.
That's almost like the inspector should know if it's a sleeping room.
Yeah.
Sure. Sorry, I got to...
Well, in 8 point...
I'm working through here.
You work out too hard.
In our report, it's general information. It's not a deficiency. It's just going to say something like, there are not this or that or that. and so we're just going to check that button. But
recommend adding.
But I'm not even going to put that. I don't.
If it says absence, does that mean absence in every area of the home that's required today?
Oh, yeah.
That's my question. I think that's the inference, and I think the inspector should probably know where GFIs are required today. I think that's okay to require that for the inspector.
Constantly changing. And right. It's constantly changing, so yeah.
It is, and that's municipalities can do their own thing, and field inspectors can override something, and, you know, there's just that's interesting.
Yep.
Now that you look.
All right, so I think we're good where we are on the GFIs, then. We're going to leave them in, and we're all going to struggle for the next 20 years until these get updated again, and then they'll be removed. They'll be removed next time, for sure.
I will do bet
my bottom dollar they'll be removed. But, all right. Any other discussion? Anything else on the SOPs, guys?
I've been waiting to bring this up, because I was not involved in this. Wasn't on the committee at the time.
Okay.
The deletion of the term immediate major repair.
All right.
So maybe someone could give us some background about why that was. What was the rationale behind that?
I don't have all the details in front of me. I know it was only referred to in a very limited way in the inspection. And. I think that may be the only reference to it when we were looking through for references on immediate major repair. I remember us at one point, Kurt, going through, and we realized we thought that maybe just C3 may be it. So Kurt, can you bring up C3, please? So, state conditions. So that four is where that got changed. Then right, we moved down one number, I think. So major defect got kind of moved into that, right? You know, there was another. We're trying to figure out the scenario where we needed the immediate, major repair, and major defect wasn't, you know, couldn't do the job. The term immediate, first of all, was not serving us at all, because that gets way too subjective. So the scenario might be, the AC unit's working fine, great temperature splits, but it's a noisy air handler. And so it's not an immediate repair, it's working, but it could be a major defect. And so we tried to come up with scenarios where when did we really need the immediate major repair definition? And we could look at that definition, but it got too subjective, and it just seemed like the major defect seemed like a good general umbrella for it's a call or it's not a call. So that's how we got here.
Yeah, also when it comes to our clients looking at it, you know, I'm going to say, well, our home inspector says it has to be done immediately. You know, in other words, during the, not necessarily the inspection period, but at least for the escrow period.
Yeah. What's immediate, though? It was just.
Yeah, I know, but the thing is, they're using it in the wrong context.
Right. Right. But you know,
that's why the word immediate.
So, John, that's how we pretty much got to where we were at, and why we thought we could live without it. There was one other person, Alan Shelton, did send something in saying that he thought we might be missing something, you know, from immediate. But again, it still looked like major defect covered the concern. So,
and you're keeping major defect as unsafe or not functioning, right? Is the definition, the essence of the definition, a system or component that is unsafe or not functioning. The primary function is not working properly.
Yeah, I don't know if we tweaked that and said not working properly or something. I'd have to see. We'd have to go back to.
I'm just looking at this versus this. It says
it's unsafe or not functional.
A system or component that is unsafe or the primary function is not working properly.
That remains in as a reference term. So if you look at the definition of immediate major repair, number one and number two of that definition both require like this predictive crystal ball skill set to pull off. You know, how do we know if it's going to worsen appreciably 100% of the time or anything, or cause further damage? Remember, these are always just minimum requirements. If you believe that to be true, put it in your report. You know, this doesn't prevent you from going the extra mile. This is like the building code, just the basic. You don't have to argue about whether it will cause further damage in an EAC hearing because some client's complaining against you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, right now in statute 32101, purpose and definition, an inspection report has to, it talks about immediate major repair. So I don't understand why we're taking it out. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason to take it out. This is going to be contradictory to what we're going to be changing, because according to the home inspection report definition, you need to state if anything's in need of immediate major repair. So now we've got a conflict.
I mean, again, it was taken out because it was confusing and it wasn't really serving anybody, including the consumer. So that's why it was taken out. But if there's confusion, we need to fix that, right? Confusion in statute?
Yeah, 32101, right number 18.
I don't understand why you need two definitions. They're so closely aligned. And if statute requires immediate major repair to be in, then let's take out major defect, perhaps, mm-hmm. and combine them.
Yeah, major defect there, too.
Are you serious? Oh, yeah.
You're the one that wrote this. Come on.
Yeah. That was so long ago. I was young and dumb.
Well, we never would have written it this way today, would we have?
Let's leave it.
I think so.
Yeah, I think so. That's
the reason that I brought it up, because I think one of the problems is here we are discussing this, you know, wordsmithing this, and your 938 other inspectors in the state are looking at this, but not at the same level. They've already locked into a definition in their mind. That's how they're defining their report set. We go in and we say, well, actually, 2.2C3 is changing. And they go, wait, you can't change that.
Yeah.
What do you mean, right?
Yeah, and the feedback we're getting, several of them are regarding this immediate.
I think it's too, to me, it's too significant for us to just.
Yeah, it's just in statute. You have to define it.
Yeah. All right, so we have to leave it in. So, Kurt, we have to leave 2C3 in with. Thank you, John, for bringing that up. I'd like to go back now, and then we're going to need to bring the definition back in, Kurt or Hayden, for immediate major repair. Do we need to do anything with immediate major repair definition now? And is there something we can clean up there to try to address concerns? I guess is the question.
I think immediate major repair.
I think it's fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So leave immediate major repair definition the way it is.
Yeah.
Leave it that nebulous, huh?
Well, how is
it? It may cause further damage. Get your crystal ball.
Right.
No. How's an inspector supposed to determine whether something's going to worsen
appreciably?
Through experience, you're going to understand it. I mean, you're going to know if something, if it's an obvious thing. If not, you can't be held responsible for it. That's all there's got.
Right. So, we all or nothing on this definition?
Well,
I don't like it in general.
I don't know if we'll be likely to do any of the following.
All right.
The difference between those two terms is just so bizarre.
But I, in order to clarify this,
Okay, I think the spirit of this is that we don't start to get into, as a profession, whether or not you or I doing inspections together would define something in a nebulous way that we know is not an immediate major defect, right? You might call it out and I might not, right? Mm. We're trying to unify this in a way that we can all agree this is something of real significance and we would all call it an immediate major repair. That's our distinction. It's not a question of whether or not we've got some cosmetic defect that you call out and maybe I don't or vice versa. The issue that I have, and like this gentleman in the corner, I've been an inspector for over 20 years. I look at this and I go, my brain is oriented in a certain way. This is what I've defined. This is what I'm looking for. And now we're saying, let's flip that on an edge and now not define it that way. And I think that's a dangerous position to be in unless we have very strong supporting reasons behind it.
Yeah, well said. It is confusing in my opinion. And it's a little nebulous.
That came from Ashley long ago.
And we can't think of something better. And since it's in statute, let's just leave it for now. It's not hurting anyone, but it's probably a little bit nebulous. All right. John, anything else? All right.
Thank you. Do you care about extra spaces or missing spaces?
So we do want to, on the final draft, we're going to want to, you know, clean up anything space-wise.
Section 10 has an extra space and
improper punctuation.
Yeah, Kurt. I'm sorry. Hang on.
Sorry. I need clarification. So I've added the definition back in.
However,
something in these standards probably has to go back to that definition, and there's no point to it. So where in the actual standards is this word used?
So where in the standards it's referred to is...
2.2C3.
So 2.2.Charlie.3,
2.2C3. Okay.
And so that's going to need to go back in, and I realize... We're going to have to bring up number 3 and 4 probably again, right, at 2C3, because we're not just talking about adding in 2C3 again.
I guess that's why I need the clarification, because
it's
being defined, so where does it need to come back into these standards?
We need to get the original standards back. Who's got the...
Oh. So you just need to be verbatim as to what it was before?
Yeah.
Now we need to make sure that it's not stepping on anything else that we have here in 2C.
Sure.
Correct.
And we added in 3. Right?
So we've got the major defect in 4.
So 4 was originally the 3.
Do we just add that in for 5? Is the question.
It was replaced with that, isn't it? 4 was it?
Yeah, we...
So, the old 3 is the new 4 with major defect plus some other...
It's 1 in here.
And actually, the way this is, we would remove... we would remove 4 and put in 3, looks like. Because we reworded it and made it 4.
So three is what you added, right?
Three is what we had, but then we took 3 and we morphed it into 4 here, right?
That was before my time, but I think three was added.
This three was added. This three was not in the standard.
Correct.
Right.
So now all you need to do
is we need to remove 4 and put the old one back in.
Right. Yeah. Which would be 3.
Old 3.
Old 3. We need to put old 3 in where new 4 is.
Right.
I think the only difference is the use of
major defect.
Let me make sure. Changed after 2.
Systems or components so inspected, which were found to contain.
Which were found to be in need of immediate major repair.
Yeah. Hold it on the cut and paste.
You just paste it in here, and yeah, it gives me a comparison.
It's like this. We were almost verbatim swapping the word out in your recommendations.
Yeah, that's all it was.
Correct monitor. We had a couple correct corrections made. Correct monitor. Evaluate. I think so three as it stands looks good, right? Mm-hmm. The new three.
So just take four out and make that one four.
But you have to italicize the stuff that, okay, you know that. Yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, we need to italicize immediate major repair because it's in definitions, right?
And appropriate persons.
And Scott, I had a question on three. By them stating, using words such as satisfactory or repair needed, I'm that one that uses that terrible appeared serviceable. Mm-hmm. Am I in compliant or am I restricted?
If somebody files a complaint and it goes up to the board, they will be able to tell you whether or not that terminology meets the requirements in there. I can't tell you.
Can we put IE in there?
IE?
Yeah. Ahead of it?
I don't like that.
The report talking about checklist.
Yeah, that's more for the checklist.
The report and checklist are off supplement.
There's a new example thing in the checklist.
That a reasonable person can determine whether it's a positive or a problem.
I don't think we want to put examples in the SOPs. We'll put that in the report review checklist.
You just did. You put satisfactory or repair needed. I'm just talking different terminology.
Yeah, I just don't want to say such as, you know, and start over.
Well, it says such as.
It does say such as.
Does it?
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you just say specifically descriptive terminology or defined terminology?
Correct.
And bag the satisfactory repair needed.
Yeah.
You can do that.
That would save me.
Save me too.
Not just me. A lot of people that don't use those two terms.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't use those.
Good idea. Such as is terrible.
So you guys want me to get rid of four?
Correct.
Get rid of the old four, because four. Just so you know, evaluated by appropriate persons is no longer defined, so I'm not italicizing that.
Okay.
Oh, that's right. You're right. That's right. It's no longer defined.
And so is major repair, which used to be there, does that need to be used somewhere else?
No.
Major defect?
No, because we just put it in place of immediate.
Right.
But three, we didn't lose anything else in that section, Kurt.
But you're going to change what three is now, Kurt?
Just major defect is no longer in the SOP with that change. So,
under what?
Well, we have major defect referred to, though. Don't, aren't we
it's
using
in
it?
Some,
aren't we using it somewhere else?
That was it. I just did a search.
Really? We're not using major defect.
Well, again, so I have defect here in the navigation. So I have defects, which is not what we're looking for, defect, and then major defect. By making that replacement, we put in immediate major repair, but now there's no major defect in the SOP.
There's no other major defect,
but it's in the glossary.
So you guys got to put major defects somewhere in your SOP.
Well, it's in the glossary then.
Yeah, it's in there.
It doesn't
have to be in the body.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't.
I mean, a major defect is underneath the major repair. So it's major repair.
Okay.
However, we have to go back to three that we were discussing, the such as, because I think you still have it in.
Yeah.
There.
Let's just do the final cleanup on that. Let's just leave major defect definition in there. It's not hurting anybody.
So inspected with specifically descriptive or defined terminology, and where we are getting rid of the rest, right?
Yeah.
After terminology, we put in period.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I like that. All right, good.
One last chance here. All right. Any other comments? Yes.
And just to be specific, eight, whatever the ones about carbon monoxide alarms, smoke alarms, there's smoke detectors and fire alarms. they're different. So we should be talking about smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors, not smoke alarms. There's no such thing as a smoke alarm.
Yeah.
Fire alarm or smoke detector?
We did have a discussion on alarm versus detector when we were recrafting these, and we felt we were good with where we were, because they are two different things. The detector and the alarm are two different components of the device, for sure.
Right.
So I think we're okay.
Well, a fire alarm would be, this whole building has a fire alarm.
Right.
But this room might have a smoke
has
detector.
Has a detector, right. Right.
The detector is what senses whether or not there's smoke. The alarm is what you're hearing. So actually those components are not the same.
Yeah, right.
So the definition, most definitions, it's a smoke alarm, because with the detector only, you wouldn't be notified that there's a problem.
Right.
So that's
all right.
Splitting hairs. But
so
by doing a test, you know if the alarm works.
Let's try to put a bow on this, folks. Any other discussion on these standards? It's taken us like a year and a half or so to get to this point. Roger, you're okay with where we're at? I think we got a pretty good set of standards to move forward with,
yeah,
folks. I think we made really good changes.
There's ways to work around that's the report writing.
Right.
You know,
I know.
We're going to address that.
How much liability you want to assume?
Right.
I mean, you don't put anything in your report, you got high liability. You put everything in your report, you got low liability.
All right. I'm guessing we should probably have a motion to accept these changes, Scott, or does that not matter because it's more, you have any opinion on that?
You can make a motion to forward it to the board.
So why don't we entertain a motion then to go ahead and take these and move them over to the chapter for the final blessing, and then Roger, you'll go ahead and send them in.
I'm president of the board. I know if I'm allowed.
Well, can I make that motion then?
You can, please.
Let's go ahead and make a motion that we send these standards to the Arizona ASHI for acceptance, and if it's accepted, let's send it to the board.
It's too much of a motion. I think we need to separate the and then part, but I think we just need to take the first part and send these.
Okay.
So let's just craft that, we want the motion to say we're going to send these standards with changes, right? Send these standards with changes to the AZ ASHI board. I think that's the motion, right? Standards with changes.
Sure.
So we got an as moved. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second. Further discussion?
Wait, sorry. Who seconded? John?
Yes. We have a second. This is the final stake in the ground here, so final discussions. All right. Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? So the motion passes, so we will be sending these changes, if you can just send them to Roger, the final draft with it, and Roger will get with his board. And then once that's done, need to circle back with right. Judith and Kurt, and they need to put the supplemental rules package together just for these. Now, you're just going to have just these changes in, Judith, in that package, is that the idea?
No, I think there might be a few other changes, but nothing to do with the standard.
But other stuff that's outside of this. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Do we want to send it to the board, or do we need to wait until the next meeting? How does this go? We get it back.
Once Roger sends it to us, we would want it to go to the board.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Is that just standard, or do we need to?
What are you thinking, Kurt?
I'm thinking, like, in my mind, what's going to happen is that this will go to AZ ASHI. They need to have their vote. They say this is the new standards. We were going to put them for a supplemental as well as some other things. And the L&R committee's meeting next week. And then they're going to look at the supplemental as well. And then the next board meeting, which is November 7th, is where the board would vote and say we want the supplemental to be produced or not. I mean, I hope they do. So, yeah. But
right.
So well, when do you need it back?
Next week. Before November 7th, for sure.
So a month.
You got a month.
Well, we
but
need
before
a,
that,
about a week.
You got a couple of weeks.
No, I just want to
generally speaking,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
got a couple of weeks to.
Okay.
I mean, if it was theoretically going to go on the November
doesn't it throw the rules like you said?
Board meeting.
That'd be next week, right? Next week.
Probably need it.
Next week.
By Halloween or November 1st at the latest.
That's fine.
Yeah, I just
want to know.
All right. So this motion is passed. I just want to thank everybody. This is a ton of work that has kind of coalesced here. And if there was a more efficient way to have done it where we could have done this final vetting prior to the public comment period without the second rules pass, if there was another way to do it, we would have. But I feel good about what we did. Let us take a quick 5 minute and then we're going to come back and hopefully have a very short end to our meeting, okay?
We only have till noon.
We can skip CMP.
All right, five minutes, guys. 5 minutes. Thank you. We back in session here officially.
Yes.
Thank you all. We won't be going too much longer here, less than a half hour probably. So onto our agenda, agenda 5C with regards to the education requirements for certification. That certainly is an ongoing thing, and let's take a moment on that before we move on. We do think we're at a point here where we're going to be redefining the home inspection curriculum. We discussed last meeting adding a couple of hours to the curriculum, which would include report writing, our newly revised AZSOPs, the question is going to be, and I think the next meeting we have, we want to start looking at a draft of that curriculum. I think that's probably the next step, Keith, and I know you're kind of leading the charge on that. The bigger question is going to be, you know, we're thinking at some point, maybe early next year, we'll submit a separate rules package for this curriculum changes. But at that time, then we can see, does it make sense to include the private post-secondary requirement
right
in there? Maybe, right? And maybe group all that together. Is there something with parallel training we want to do and group that in there since we think we can do that within our charge? So maybe kind of grouping that together as, you know, all the education together maybe early next year into another package is kind of where we're leaning on that as far as a direction for some education changes. I'm not quite getting into CEs yet, but at least for the curriculum changes.
Yeah, CEs is a whole other.
Right, yeah. But does that make sense to the rest of the committee as far as a plan for the education changes?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Then we will table and please keep on the agenda item 5C for next meeting and 5D. We'll kind of group those together, even though the parallel stuff is a little more after. Well, actually, it's not. It's part of the certification. But as we just found out, you know, I didn't realize that the parallels could be under that umbrella of the private post-secondary. I hadn't really thought that part of it through before, so that makes the more reasons to kind of group any kind of parallel requirements on the education side and with the rest of our education. But those requirements may not be for licensure, it may be afterwards in order to be maybe a parallel inspector if we decide that. So we're going to table 5C, 5D. We're on to 5E, and I don't want to have to decide on anything, but I do want to have a brief discussion and present the concern with the pay-to-play. And just before we dig into that, 5F, discussion of initial applicant assessments. Can somebody refresh my memory on what we're supposed to discuss on that?
Yes.
Thank you.
I did an evaluation there was a second evaluation after the first report was reviewed, and they sent back requests for changes.
Okay.
And there was about 15 items that needed to be changed that weren't included in the inspection report. And I don't think there's anything established for the report reviewer to say, like, maybe we can come up with a number, 5 items missing, it's okay, but 15 is a lot. Mm. And if this is their best shot at getting licensed, I just...
So I keep, when you say okay, just to clarify, you mean okay that the reviewer says, hey, you need to fix these 5 things you're deficient, but rather than...
You meet the standard, but there's 5, here's... There's got to be some kind of a limit here, because 15 is a lot of items missing.
Right, let's just take a moment on this, and then we'll move on. But the challenge is that some items are more important than others, right, Keith? And there's, missing a safety item. The bedroom window isn't opening. That's way more important than there's a dent in the door of the oven, but it's working fine, right?
You've got a report checklist, a supplement checklist,
right.
84 items. I mean, if you're trying to get your license, you've got to be on your best behavior at this point. You're looking at your report. You're going to go through the checklist. You're going to make sure you got all 84. This is what I'm talking about.
So in other words, do we set a criteria where it's close enough? Is that your point, I guess? As far as, some number of exclusions in the report.
Yeah. I mean, we've all thought
whether it's 3 or 5
or a half a dozen was okay. But boy, when it gets over that.
Any other comments on this?
Kurt,
go ahead.
So the board staff is actually going to sit down with Steve, who is our home inspection report assessor. This is his 1-year anniversary.
Hey.
Did you bring up the 10% pay raise?
But we are actually going to have a sit down and look at the policies and procedures. They were developed a year ago specifically for his position. We're going to have a sit down, round table, and we're going to look at these policies and procedures, how they've been used this year and so forth, and just get into the discussion. And I think what Keith has brought up and why this was agendized, gives us an idea also what maybe this committee would like us to discuss at that.
Okay, and certainly worthy of it. So when you guys have your discussion, and let's leave it on the agenda, and we'll hit it next time, and see if maybe there's a recommendation back to the committee on maybe it is 5, and that's...
Well, that's what Can you kind of tell us, are you getting a lot of them that are deficient? And does it reflect the parallel inspectors presenting that or helping them?
I keep a log of every one of them. When I run into something that's really bad like that, I highlight the parallel inspector's name, so I kind of have a running log of whose reports are, don't seem to be following all the standards or meeting standards. And it's not a real big list, but it seems to be growing. It is growing, and it's getting a little bit more more prevalent. Every time I do another assessment, I'm getting more and more of them. So,
yeah. Would it be helpful if there was a criteria for a number of defects and how you kind of rated them, if you will? Would that be helpful?
We have a guideline that I use, and so that's kind of helpful sometimes. In some cases, there's other cases where I get lost. I have so many things come up with some of them that I just don't know how to respond.
There are
some problems.
Yeah, we just want to make it as efficient, as easy as possible. And I know you got a tough job, so we're really looking for your input. So
I think we should talk about it maybe at the next meeting.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah,
let's do that. Thank you. We'll table that rest of that discussion for now. Judith, do you have much on the director's report? You're probably not going to have much to say. I just wasn't going to see how much time we have here.
Statistics and usual.
You probably don't have a whole lot, though, right?
No, nothing really.
Okay.
New.
So
Kurt and I are presenting at the Asiashi conference.
Right, on Saturday.
Maybe we'll get some good comments or feedback or whatever.
That's excellent. So let's take agenda item 5E, and I just want to present this, my concerns to the committee. Maybe they're not other people's concerns, but there have been a number of concerns voiced to me from inspectors across Arizona. And this has to do with specifically the rule. It's a rule, not statute, so it's a rule. Bring that back up. It's 32, is that
32.101?
This
is statute.
This is
R430.
Oh, the 3030, right. Okay. So this is regarding home inspectors' conflicts of interest. And I know David has some history with some of this. And it's broken up into the four parts. And the challenge is,
there should be a challenge. Black and white, but go ahead.
Yeah, the challenge is understanding what B1 is. The certified home inspector shall not pay directly or indirectly in full or part a commission or compensation as a referral or finder's fee to a real estate company, an office or real estate broker or salesperson or employee or independent contractor in order to obtain referrals for home inspection business. This prohibition includes but is not limited to participation in pay-to-play programs by any name, example, preferred vendor, approved vendor, marketing partner, marketing services agreement. So B1 right here is the reality of what's happening, boots on the ground, is that just about every real estate company is selling access to their agents. Many companies lock out other home inspectors because they have pay-to-play program. You want to be in the office, it's $500 a month. You want to put your brochures in there, it's X amount a month. You want our email lists, it's $300 a month, or it's $3,000 for the year. And if I say, well, but our laws say that we're not allowed to pay you guys for access to your realtors, they say, that's fine, everybody's doing it, the next home inspection company is going to do it. And so we have widespread violations, if you will, of this law. And we have no enforcement, and we have total confusion. And, you know, we understand that a home inspector would never, you know, like what it refers to on item B3, you'd never want to, B2, you'd never want to take any kind of compensation, remuneration to alter a home inspection report. That's like flagrant violation. It's like no way can you influence the contents of a report. But what B1 is talking about looks and smells like normal marketing, normal promotion for a home inspection company.
I don't agree with that at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's no preferential treatment. This is a totally messy situation here.
I've been doing inspection for 20 years. I've never paid to play, and I've always said you cannot do that.
All right. Yeah. No. And you're one of the few, right?
You're one of the few that goes by that,
right?
Well, I get so many students calling me after they get licensed saying, "Hey, you keep telling me I can't pay to play." I go, "You can't." Well, I go over here, they won't let me do it unless it's $2,000 a month. And I tell them, you cannot do that.
Right. So you're confirming what I'm saying, that it's being violated.
So we have to put a wire out, let everybody know they can't do that is what we need to do.
Right, so we either need to reword it, enforce it, or lose it. But we need to do something with this. Kurt, and I'll get to you.
Just so you are aware, we do have actually quite a number of open cases currently right now regarding this. It is right now going to be enforced. Or going through the process, I should say.
Because the board can only enforce what it knows about.
Right. Right. So,
now that brings up, Scott, is that true? I mean, the office staff can look for discrepancies, right?
The staff can open an investigation based
on their own.
On materials received or...
Well, the board can open investigations. You do not have to have a complaint in order for an investigation to be opened by the board.
Correct.
But the board has to be aware of something that may constitute a violation of statutes or rules, and the board does not have an independent team that goes out in the field undercover looking for the potential violations. So it is a matter of if the board becomes aware of something that could constitute a violation of statutes or rules and may open up an investigation. If it does, then the investigation will proceed until the board dismisses it or issues a final order in the case.
So the inspectors are worried that if they bring it to the BTR's attention, that their name is going to be used on this violation. So they can actually let somebody know about it, staff know about it, and then their name doesn't have to be on it? Is that correct?
There is a statute in Arizona that actually does not allow for anonymous complaints. Now, that said, I cannot speak to all the means by which the board may become aware of something. And certainly, again, if a board staff member or a board member becomes aware of something, a board member could even request that board staff look at something they become aware of. So if any committee member is aware of somebody who may be violating board statutes or rules, they can notify board staff, they can notify the board directly. Filing an actual complaint, there is a statute that does not allow for anonymous complaints generally with boards, but at the same time, the board does have statutory authority to open up an investigation on its own recognizance.
Yes, you have a comment here.
Department of Labor has told me that you can have an anonymous.
The Department of Labor may be able to.
Yeah, email, 800 number. That's why I suggested it in my letter. Yes. Because, again, to your point, Keith, is that
yes.
correct? To your point, again, I've done this 20 years. Spoken to a lot of home inspectors, and they won't come forward because they don't want their name attached, and they don't have any confidence that anything's going to be done. And Kurt and I have spoken about this, and he said that you, whoever you is, are going to start subpoenaing records, and you're actually going to try to go through and try to enforce some of this. Because at this point in time, I told you, I spoke to one of the largest brokerages in town, and I said, hey, I knew one of their home inspectors had fallen off their preferred list. I said, what's it take to get on? $2,500 a month. They just said, and I said, well, I can't do that. And, quote, not our problem.
Right.
Yeah. You'll have to decide whether the gain is worth your risk.
Right. It's a business decision.
So and what they do is they dissect this and they go, well, we're not doing this or that and the other. You're a sponsor. I mean, they constantly play the word games. Or they do the back door where you don't pay to be on the preferred vendors list, but you're still the preferred vendor, and then you pay on the back end to pay for all their appreciation luncheons and happy hours and all that. It's the same thing. You're still paying them. So for me, in 2004, if you remember, in 2004, there was a black and white statement put out that said you can't participate, period.
Exactly.
They didn't give all these words that you could. And in my estimation, and I'll shut up, it's got to be black and white. You can't have any financial arrangement with a realtor, period. You can't buy them a cup of coffee. Because if you don't have it that stringent, they're just going to play games with it, and then it's back on your
your board app.
Yeah, so that's our challenge. It, you know, in most ways, B1 is nothing more than advertising. It's paid advertising to get your name out in front of
You're limiting it to big companies that can afford $2,500 a month. And you've got a single inspection company, they can't do it.
Well, the challenge is if most we can do, Keith, to enforce it is to turn each other in, right? Anonymously or not. To try to enforce this without the ADRE, without coming in on the real estate side, we'll never do anything with this. There'll be constant confusion, you know?
Then why have it?
No, that's my point. Why have it if we can't enforce it, you know? I mean, I see your point that...
Do you belong to one of those programs?
I do.
Let me give you some history on this, just because I'm so old. I've been around so long. So this prohibition existed with a period. It has always existed with a period after the binder's fee. And then at about the 2014-2015 time frame, I got invited to a meeting. It was actually at that time a team of realtors, and they wanted to do a program, and they had built spreadsheets to analyze each deal and keep track of it and pay a direct referral fee, just clear violation. I was like, you're crazy. You know, look here, read this and tell me if that's okay. And anyway, so they came back and they were like, they had a solution to my objection, which was they set up a shell company that when you look up the address, it was actually an apartment complex. It was one of the units in one. So it was the worst of the worst possible situation.
Let me jump in for just a minute. Before the conversation goes too far, I would like to remind everybody that we are in an open meeting of a committee of the Arizona Board of Technical Registration, and the board may have a need to proceed through normal investigative routes concerning any information that it determines may lead to indication of a violation of board statutes and rules. So, you say
we may need to limit the discussion?
I cannot make a suggestion as to the direction of the discussion. I can simply remind people that the board may have to take action with regards to information disclosed.
Okay. Fine. Understood.
There's just a total lack of clarity at all. And, you know, the definition that needs to be analyzed, too, is referral or finder's fee. That one's the one that's always existed. Versus advertising.
This is so black and white. I just don't get it.
Yes.
I really don't.
Well,
if the word gets out that we're not going to enforce this, it's out.
You're right.
Maybe we
want to take a look at how we could enforce it, but how do we do it without the ADRE? We would have to try to work with them and work with the realtors, Keith. That's the only way we can have any kind of enforcement. We can't just do a home inspection.
Why don't we send an email out? Kurt's really good at this. And just remind people they cannot participate in it. Okay? Boom. Start there.
We could, let's wait until the dust settles here, right?
Yeah, and one more thing I would like to point out. Any questions of enforcement are going to be done at a board level. So this is a committee of the board, but the committee really can only look at the language and make recommendations concerning language. There may be a good deal of enforcement going on, and the committee really should be careful about suggesting on the record that there wouldn't be any enforcement, because there may be some very surprised home inspectors in the near future who find there is enforcement. So this committee cannot make any statements about whether or not the board will be doing any enforcement for this.
So in the future, if we revisit this early next year, will there be some more concrete guidelines provided, Scott, so that it makes sense to not send anything out right now? Let's see what gets decided with these cases.
From a legal standpoint, I can't say what's going to happen in terms of cases, but what I can say is that the committee's option with this, in terms of the language itself, legally there isn't anything specifically wrong with it, because this language provides for the board to be able to take legal action, and the board has an investigative process which may lead to people having disciplinary action taken against licenses for violations of this rule. If the issue is real estate companies, then this committee may not be able to do anything. It may be more a matter of real estate board doing something with their agents, because the board does have enforcement authority over people who violate this rule as it is written.
Right on.
Okay. All right, let's wrap it up soon here.
Okay. ADR, he did send out an email, and they quoted the BTR standards verbatim. They did say this is illegal. I mean, it was about as strongly worded as I've seen in the 20-some years that I've done
this. The ADRE
this.
Sent something out
the
recently?
The ADRE sent it out in their annual newsletter, and it said, real estate agents, please knock it off. Quit tempting home inspectors with a process that could possibly cost them their license. I mean, it was very strongly worded.
Interesting.
So I don't know that we could say much more than what they said.
So that's 50% of the problem. Now we'll send an email to our home inspectors. I really think the email's the way to start it.
Didn't we share that's been done.
Oh, a long time ago.
Yeah,
we've
but
got a lot of people in there now. A lot of
people. Right, let's try to wrap it. Kurt, you have something here?
Oh, I was just going to say that he's correct. That we had drafted a letter that was presented to the commission, which was then shared with the real estate. I can't recall if we sent out a mass email to home inspectors regarding that article.
Yeah.
It's been, that was like a 2000.
We did.
Yeah, so that was like a year and a half.
It was just about 6 months ago. Because I use it in some material.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if my gut feel is to wait and see how some dust might settle and revisit this at our next meeting. I mean, if you feel strongly about trying to send a notice out, Keith, we can, as far as, okay, this, but we don't know if it's a moving target.
It's a reminder. It's already a rule. Let's just remind the guys that, hey, you can't do this.
I'm fine with that. Let's remind them of the law. But let's keep it on the agenda, please.
Can I ask a question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Scott, is there any law in Arizona that one regulated body cannot entice another regulated professional to break their rules? Anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of.
Really?
Yeah, there's nothing in the real estate rules I'm aware of. No, I'm not their attorney, but
yeah.
I'm not aware of anything in their rules that prevents them.
But not generalized between different licensed professionals.
That's not going to work. It may be a basis for a civil suit. If you were to lose your license because of something like this, you could then potentially, you may have a cause of action against the real estate professional for doing that. But because this isn't a criminal violation.
Yeah.
If it were a criminal violation, it would be a different ballgame.
Yeah, I just mean existing state law somehow, because that would give something to reference in the notice to.
If they're trying to incite you to murder somebody, that would be one thing, but it's not a criminal violation, so it's not really in the same thing. Yeah.
I still think we need to do something else with it, but for now, let's at least inform them. You know, if you want, that's fine.
May I ask one question, and I'll shut up?
Yeah, go ahead.
Is there not a statute, substantive statement, or something that we can't use to enforce?
Yeah.
Does that exist?
You got a rule right here. That's
well, I understand that, but I mean, what's the mechanism that comes in and says we fine you or we take your license? What do you do?
That's the process, the investigation.
The complaint would be filed.
Yeah.
With the BTR. Well,
okay. We investigate, and then we could move forward under 32128, if the board's general disciplinary statute. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Let's try to wrap up our meeting here. Scott, we're going to kind of table any other training till next meeting, if that's okay. And Judith, did you have any updates on your director's report?
I really don't. Just again, the statistics updates, which are nothing.
No pretty graphs.
Yeah, no.
Are we over 1,000 inspectors in the state now?
No.
No, we've got 930 active when this report was run. The statistics remain about the same, with home inspectors being 3% or slightly under for the total number of registrants that we regulate, and the complaint volume being about 30% of the complaints that come in, which is obviously disproportionate and unfortunate. But I'm looking forward to presenting at AZASHI and hope there's a good turnout. It seems like the turnout is never as big as I hope it would be.
I'm with you on that as well.
You
lower
wish
your
it was
price.
A better turnout as well, Roger.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always a good opportunity, though, to speak with whoever is there, get to meet some new faces, and usually get a few people pretty upset with me over one thing or another, but hopefully I can make friends with them before leaving. I try.
So the fiscal year start in what month?
July 1st.
July, okay.
So that's why we got some 24, huh?
Well, they don't all close out during the fiscal year, so... Oh, those are applications, sorry.
Applications submitted in FY24. Mm-hmm.
Do we know how many actually get their license?
This is
our numbers. Well, that's great. Gotcha.
Okay.
Great chart.
Well, Hayden gets credit for all his lovely charts.
Yeah, awesome job,
Hayden. Thank you.
Awesome job. This really helps. So there's no drop-off in inspector applications for licensing, huh?
It's going to be a good year.
Keep rolling in. So... this is total, I see total BTR and then home inspector. Not as big of a percentage as I thought.
It's quite a few.
It's a pretty high percentage.
Yeah.
Compared to
and
the
it does seem like we're trending up a little bit, huh?
We're just
we are trending up a little bit on complaints, but that's why we're focusing on education and curriculum, right? We'll try to help address some of that. Good. So I'm trying to understand this one when I was looking at it before.
So that's what I was saying, like the percentage of overall registrants at this agency is the green. So your home inspectors are a relatively small percentage.
Oh, but we're 37% of the complaints. Right.
Of
oh,
the
yeah.
Complaints that come
yeah. And we're proud of that.
So,
yeah.
I mean, without mincing words, if you were an autonomous board, you'd be insolvent.
Right.
Immediately.
We wouldn't be self-sustaining, you're saying.
Right.
Because of the cost of the complaints, is that it? The administrative
and
complaint costs?
The applications are,
Yeah. But keep in mind, from a regulatory standpoint, and you could talk to any state, they're probably the same numbers for their home inspector.
Do you know what? I would love to talk to any state. I wish with all my heart that there was some kind of national... bring together all of the regulatory boards.
Aurelo.
They
go
do
back
with
to
every
Aurelo.
Other profession.
Go
they
back.
Bring
yeah.
us together so we can talk about what's going well, what's not going well from state to
yeah.
state.
All you have is Aurelo.
I don't even know what that is.
That is the Association for Real Estate Professionals. It's basically all the regulation for real estate professionals, A-R-E-L-L-O. In the beginning of the BTR was part of Aurelo and went to some Aurelo conferences to get information on putting all the rules and licensing together. So Aurelo was a help back 23 years ago when we were putting all this together. But they were more about regulation than rules, but at the time it was more about regulation and getting the regulation right. But anyway, that's the only group I know of, Judith, a national group. They're all about real estate legislation and rules.
I've reached out to the National ASHI Association. No one ever reaches back.
Yeah, and I will tell you real quick, I've reached out to the ASHI Legislative Committee regarding CEs.
And right now there are 38 states have some kind of home inspector licensing, 38 out of 50. I don't have a hard number, but vast majority have CEs. It's a majority, I don't know if the majority of them have some kind of CE requirements, just, you know, I don't have a hard number, but that was the feedback from Ashley Legislative Chair.
If that was ever to move forward, you'd need those hard numbers, because I could say about all the professions we regulate, most states have continuing education.
Good. You know, the point with home inspector complaints, and then we can move on, is that our profession is fraught with complaints. Anything that happens at the house, we are at the epicenter of any kind of complaint that could ever happen at any point in time, because we were there for 3 hours. So it's just the nature of our profession, it really is. So even home inspection companies, multi-inspector companies, it's common to have complaints come in, even if you're doing a perfect job. So that's just the nature of our profession, frankly.
Here's a great chart here. No disciplinary action after the complaint, 13%.
Yeah, so the point is that we're getting...
we're getting some pretty good complaints, but maybe a lot of them aren't being disciplinary.
Let me go back up, because I think that's...
I'm seeing that the other way, actually. So I'm seeing the home inspectors getting disciplined more.
Well, this chart right here, if I got this right, Hayden, this indicates that in FY23, 45% of complaints against home inspectors resulted in discipline, whereas 55% were either dismissed or allowed.
Yeah. Right.
Correct.
Compared to the rest of it, so there's more sustained complaints for home inspectors, right? That's what I'm reading this, right?
Filed, yes.
Right. So.
So are these numbers trending up year over year?
I don't know what the trend.
They've been about the same since I've been here, but I've only been here 2.5 years.
It's about the same, I think, 5 years ago.
Yeah. Land surveyors and home inspectors have always been the highest, just because... Yeah,
interesting though on that chart on substantiated complaints. We had never really looked at that before as compared.
We have all the data. You just ask and Hayden makes the magic happen in the graph. But that's what matters. You know, if you go, you want to make any change at all, you have to have all the statistics to show and trends, and it's all about the numbers.
Okay, good. Thank you. Anything else, Judith, you had?
No.
Kurt, nothing else? Okay. So, future agenda items. So, we will we'll have the pay to play, please. We will have item 5F, the discussion of initial applicant assessments, and revisit that after your internal meeting. And then we're going to have 5C and D also will be continued on the next agenda. We'll try to look at, get closer to a draft of that. And what else for future agenda items, folks? Anything else?
Pretty
obviously,
full plate right there.
There's always the status of our package. Anything else before we adjourn? I'll entertain a motion to adjourn then.
I don't need to schedule the next future meeting.
Oh, I'm sorry, future meeting. Excuse me, thank you. So, as far as needs to meet, do we need to meet any more this year, Judith, is the question. Do we need to get together before the first of the year, is the question. What do you guys think?
I mean, we're going to have another 30-day comment period when the supplemental.
That's right, another comment period.
So we could tentatively schedule a date.
I would say we have to find December. Because if November 7th is when they say yes, let's do a supplemental, I would have to send it to the SOS.
Secretary of State.
And then they would have to let me know when it's published, and then that's when it starts at 30
days. Yeah. So. I mean, we could set a date in December, and then we could always bump it if we needed to.
Yeah, I mean...
Or do you want to just...
It's really just up to the...
If you want us to try to do first half of December, we can. Otherwise, we'll bounce it to January.
I think January is
good.
Unless you really want us here in December.
You know,
where are you guys?
We've got big parties.
I was thinking about it, Judith.
Yeah.
Since Ventia is technically supposed to go live in December, maybe pushing this beyond that so we can, so staff can focus on going live with the licensing system might be
you're,
nice.
You're living in high hopes that
that's no, but still.
So okay. Let's look at January.
What's going to go live?
Our online platform. Okay.
An online meeting platform?
No, online licensure.
Licensure platform. Okay, got it. So how about 16th or 17th of January, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Scott. You know, we need to introduce Scott as our new board member representative. So it has to be the architect or the engineer. Scott is our civil engineer.
I have to introduce Jen, sorry.
I am so sorry.
I walked in.
I'm not worried about it.
You're wondering who the heck this guy
being
is.
Being here with us. And so Keith is our, technically our public board member. Scott is our engineer board member.
Thank you.
Representative. So, Scott Sales. We have to be specific. We've got dueling Scott.
He's sharp. He is really sharp. I'm telling you.
So,
we're very lucky.
What about... If you do the 16th, there's a state holiday, I think the day before is an okay day.
Yeah, what is it? Right around Mark.
We can push it the week after if you want.
Well, in January.
15th is Mark.
But that's just, that's with licensing. That's really the period.
Oh, wait.
Yeah. So,
is it fifth online?
Yeah.
You cut me off.
You can come in person if you want.
What do you think, Judith? You want to try that week, the 16th,
17th? Anybody have a day on the
16th?
16th,
Tuesday
the
16th? Do you want the day? Would you prefer Wednesday the 16th?
16th. Whatever the
group is better for, I'm just
17th. Small cog. No, 17th is better for me, but
17th?
I have a 17 over here.
17th work for everybody?
That's got to be
17th?
Wide open. That's a Wednesday, right?
Let's go.
Thursday. Get that. If it, Thursday the 18th, if it was in the morning, is open too.
Can you make Tuesday or not?
Yeah, I could make it. Yeah, if I had to make it. If you like Tuesday's better, then fine.
Well, it's not based on me either.
Right. Well,
just so you know. I could do either.
Is it a hardship for you, John?
Only because I have a standing meeting every Tuesday morning.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If it's okay with everybody, why don't we go with the 17th on Wednesday, if it's okay, if that works.
Legal Scott.
Is that work?
It's either I or someone from the AG will be here.
Okay.
If I can't, then Chase will. I've got something scheduled for that morning, but it may not.
What time, Paul?
What do we have? So Wednesday the 17th.
What about Thursday the 18th?
We can try that.
That's fine, too.
You guys want to do Thursday the 18th, going
it's
once.
Better. Don't you buy lunch on Thursdays?
I have a conflict.
Oh. Oh, you have a conflict?
Roger's got a conflict.
Okay.
We're back to the 17th.
Sorry.
Okay.
17th, going once.
9 or 9:30?
9:30. 9:30? Yeah, let's go back to 9:30. All right. So we are Wednesday the 17th at 9:30, yes?
Yes.
Excellent.
It'll be 1 minute to spare.
It'll be next year. All right.
Yeah, well, we start 1 minute late.
How about a motion to adjourn?
Chairman, this is Scott Sales. I'd like to motion to adjourn.
Thank you, Scott. How about a second?
I second it. It's John Elson.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, thank you all so much. Good work today.
Right.